I would like to get this meeting started, ladies and gentlemen. We have a lot of testifiers on the list. We are going to limit testimony to 3 minutes to try and get done within the allotted time. I can now, at this point, call this meeting officially to order. I'm calling to order the March 22nd meeting of the House Transportation Finance Committee. Representative Johnson, do you have a motion for us?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. And in that baritone voice, were you originally a tenor? It's quite impressive. I'm glad to see you're feeling better. You're looking better, too. Anyway, I do move the minutes from March 21st.
Representative Johnson, we have not received your amendment yet. That's for tomorrow. I just figure you're working on it early with all those nice compliments.
Oh, okay.
Thank you for the motion. All those in favor of approving the minutes of March 21st, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. As I was saying, we have a number of testifiers on the list. We will try to limit the testimony to 3 minutes. We'll be marking up the bill tomorrow during our regular meeting time. With that, I don't think I have any other announcements. Does everybody have this list? If you have the list, you can see the order that we're going to take testimony in, and I appreciate your cooperation and being ready to go when your turn appears on the list. So Mr. Peterson from the department is first, followed by Margaret Donahoe from the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. Welcome to committee, Mr. Peterson. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott Peterson from the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today on House File 861. First of all, I'd like to start out by saying thank you for the increase in funding in the bill. We think it's a step in the right direction and appreciate the recognition that our state road and bridge system needs an infusion of additional revenue, and we're glad that the committee so far has agreed with that assessment. We are, however, concerned about the use of general funds as the increase, because as history has shown, the general fund being dedicated to transportation has not been terribly reliable, and of course it puts demands on revenue that's already targeted for other, or could be used for other purposes. And we definitely have a strong preference for the proposal that the governor has, which provides substantial new revenue from constitutionally dedicated sources that we know would be reliable and help us provide some efficient planning and programming for improvements to our highway system in the future. We also appreciate the inclusion of some of the department's policy proposals in the bill, including the removal of the sunset on the target group investor and business owned preference, the milk trucks on interstates, and some of the other cleanup, the outdoor advertising modifications. I think will be a big improvement in how we regulate and permit outdoor advertising. Changes in the plan dates, which will improve department efficiency, and the turnbacks and the transfer of the McKinstry moms are also very appreciative of those. Some of the concerns we have with the bill are the long list of things that are not included in the bill that the governor recommended on behalf of the department. And just a brief overview of some of those, the elimination of the funding for the passenger rail office, the lack of the general fund appropriation for our freight office, also the lack of the $1.5 million general fund for the working capital loan fund, which would support participation in our projects by small businesses. We also the $2.5 million for tribal roads assistance, the $4 million for ADA improvements associated with our Trunk Highway projects, And then a number of things that we proposed spending from the Trunk Highway Fund, including efficient optimization of our workforce and improvement and maintenance of our buildings, are unfortunately left out of the bill. One of the things I'd like to call to your attention to is the lack of appropriation for our tribal training. This is a training that we've administered to state employees to help them become familiar with Indian history and government and the way federal and state laws interact with tribal government and tribal laws and how that affects the way the department does business. And this would allow us to expand that training to other executive branch departments, which I think would pay off and improve operations for all these other agencies. And we need general funds in order for that to happen. We're also concerned with some of the other additional spending in the bill. $3.5 million for a civil air patrol facility and the Carlton County hangar. These are things that I think put some strain on our airports fund that we will have to have further conversations about. The earmark for the Highway 61 project in Red Wing that we discussed the other day, we think sets a bad precedent for local governments that negotiate agreements with the department. And a couple of the other policy provisions in there that I would just like to bring your attention that we have some concern about. The bill that allows construction, aggregate, and other materials to be hauled overweight is a concern, I think, as I mentioned in committee before, that we think it's premature to move ahead with this at this time, given the lack of information that confirms whether the operation of these vehicles on our roadways can be safe. And there's also provisions in the bill that make it very difficult for the department to adequately respond to the requirements and issue permits that allow, frankly, local road authorities to protect the roads from unnecessary damage. There's another provision here that transfers for $100 of conveyance of MnDOT, not MnDOT right away, it's actually really more for the state radio board where there's an armor tower, and we think this will, it deprives the state of the benefit of the investment it made in that parcel for that purpose. The 15% efficiencies, we've committed to 15% efficiencies of new revenue, and so we'd like to see the provision focused on that. And then just in general, like to point to the number of studies and revision or reports in the bill. They're combined with what's in the Senate. I think the total are 15 new reports and studies being required. And we like to be efficient, and some of these are, I don't argue with the fact that they might provide some good information, but we just ask that the committee, as we move forward, give some thought to the impact that this has on our employees who also have other responsibilities and duties at the department.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I have just a couple of questions for you myself. First, we constantly hear this argument that using general fund money puts transportation funds at risk. Can you tell me the last time that this happened, that we dedicated general funds to transportation and then failed to do it following that dedication?
Mr. Chairman, to my knowledge, the last time was in 2000. There was a one-time appropriation made to trunk highway projects. Part of that appropriation was general funds. I don't remember the exact amount, but I'm pretty sure it was in the year 2000. And then in 2003, there was a budget deficit, and as part of the effort the legislature took to fill that budget deficit, the unspent portion of that funding was canceled and replaced with trunk highway bonding. And I don't remember the exact amount, but it was somewhere near the original appropriation amount. And we could provide that information for you, but I think if it's in the 2003 session law chapter for transportation finance.
Well, thank you, Mr. Peterson. If I'm hearing you correctly, the commitment to transportation was fulfilled, not in the way it was originally intended in 2000, but through the authorization of trunk highway bonds in 2003. Is that correct from your estimation?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that the total spending commitment was maintained, but the promise of additional resources, I would argue, was not.
So was that commitment in 2000 intended to be an ongoing commitment in your mind, or was that a one-time commitment?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that was intended to be a one-time commitment.
Thank you. Second, I notice here in your letter that you're reacting to the prohibition on attorneys for data practices requests, and that paragraph ends by saying more costly process, it'll be a more costly process and will lengthen the time to fulfill requests for data. So this will go beyond the current four-month length of time that these requests go unanswered? I know you're not an expert in this, Mr. Peterson. I don't want to put you on the spot. I'm just making a point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With that, thank you for your members. Any
Representative just briefly, Mr. Chairman, with regard to your question about the use of the general fund, I mean, you could look at it the way that you had interpreted them that, but, you know, at the end of the day, we're still taking money from schools and nursing homes and all of the other things we fund in the general fund and using it for transportation in the example that Mr. Peterson gave in your response. So we do have precedent for this. We don't do it very often, and that's, I think, Mr. Peterson, you're underlying my main concern about how we're funding this bill.
Well, thank you, Representative Hornstein. I don't think we share exactly the same perspective on that particular incident, but we'll continue our discussions. Thank you. So, Margaret Donahoe, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Margaret Donahoe. I'm the director of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. As you know, the Transportation Alliance is the oldest and largest coalition of organizations. We represent hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans all across the state who are expecting the legislature and the governor to come to agreement this year on a comprehensive long-term transportation funding package. As I'm sure you will hear, there are many united organizations, business, labor, local governments, agricultural interests, all sorts of people from all across the state who are working together and would like to see action this session to make progress on the growing funding needs. As you can see from the handout that I'm providing, the need is significant for transportation funding. We have fallen behind, and the needs are growing. We have heard for the last several years about the importance of transportation funding and the expectation that there would be increased funding for transportation. A number of options have been provided. Some relied on increasing user fees or taxes. Some relied on dedicating existing revenue. Some have relied on one-time funding or bonding. But unfortunately, none of these were enacted into law. So in the meantime, the transportation needs are growing. All of the projects that are waiting for funding are increasing in cost. And transportation problems are going unaddressed, including serious safety concerns. And we have seen fatalities increase on our highways in the last 2 years. So we urge you to consider supporting a funding package that utilizes a combination of funding options, including some constitutionally dedicated funds, the dedication of ongoing revenue of existing funds, and bonding. Transportation projects will continue to languish until legislative leaders and the governor agree on a transportation funding package that significantly reduces the documented funding gap by providing stable, dedicated funding for our multimodal transportation system. The Alliance appreciates the work that has gone into House File 638. We do support the dedication of the sales tax on auto parts and believe that the $300 million per year number that was contained in House File 638 more accurately reflects the level of funding attributable to the current sales tax on auto parts. We also support transferring the $32 million of leased vehicle revenue currently deposited in the general fund, along with dedicating rental vehicle sales tax revenue. We support increased trunk highway bonding for the Corridors of Commerce program as long as the debt service level remains within the policy of no more than 20% of the trunk highway fund. We definitely appreciate the creation of a new local bridge account in the effort to make that funding more reliable for local governments who continue to struggle to replace and repair local bridges on their system. We are very concerned, however, with the lack of support for transit in House File 861. We do believe that transit systems all across the state are a critical component of the transportation system, and they face growing demands and funding needs. The bottom line is Transportation Alliance members stand ready to work with all of you and the governor to develop and promote a transportation funding package that can be enacted into law and that will make a difference in the lives of Minnesotans who rely on our transportation system every day. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testifier. Next, we have Jody Gertgen from Central Care Health, followed by Dorian Grilly from the Bike Alliance. Also, just remind everybody that we are keeping a three-minute time limit. We have just a little over 3 hours for all this testimony, so thank you for your brevity. Please state your name for the record and continue.
I'm Jody Gerken. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As I just mentioned, my name is Jody Gerken, and I'm the Director of Wellness for Central Care Health Foundation. Our not-for-profit healthcare system includes 6 hospitals, 6 nursing homes, senior housing in 6 communities, and more than 20 clinics throughout central Minnesota. And the Central Care Health Foundation supports health as our core mission by striving to make healthy choices the easiest choice for our customers and patients in our communities. And our state's transportation investment have everything to do with health. I want to start by thanking Chair Torkelson and the committee for including base funding of $1 million per biennium for the Safe Routes to School program and an additional $2.25 million for the program. The Safe Routes to School program has been an important avenue for our central Minnesota communities to ensure our kids have more opportunities for physical activity. As a regional health care provider, CentraCare supports transportation infrastructure to allow patients easier access to our facilities and quicker, safer transport using emergency medical transportation. Our roads and transit options need to be conduits and not barriers for our patients. Along with the urgent need for funding for roads, bridges, and transit, we also believe that investing new funding to make it easier for walking and biking, it is also critical to growth and economic competitiveness, as well as the overall health of central Minnesotans. As a leading healthcare institution, we fully understand that 80% of health happens outside of our facilities. Most of our health is determined by the built environments in our communities and neighborhoods, policies and systems in our schools and workplaces, and the dozens of personal choices we make every day. Our expertise, as you would expect, is in the healthcare world. However, given all the new modifications involved with healthcare reform, we are aware we need to think differently about primarily caring for the sick and wholeheartedly need to think more proactively about what we do to help our communities stay healthy. I want to draw attention to Representative Howe's bipartisan bill that would go far in achieving this goal. House File 1959 would create a new active transportation program at MnDOT to provide resources on a competitive basis to communities that apply. Communities such as Sauk Center, Foley, and St. Cloud, who are presently struggling for funding for various projects, which would increase opportunities for residents to safely walk and bike throughout their communities. I want to thank Representative Howe for his leadership on Safe Routes to School, and now, with his bipartisan active transportation bill, we could have safe routes to work, to church, to playgrounds, and grocery stores. I would urge this committee to consider including Representative Howe's proposal as the omnibus transportation bill moves forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And next we have Mr. Grilly, followed by Sherry Munyon. Go ahead.
My name is Mr. Chairman. My name is Dorian Grilly. I work for the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota. And I, too, am here today to support Representative Howe's amendment, which would include the language from House File 1959 that authorizes the creation of a state-level active transportation program. It's the same thing that we did in this room in 2012 when we created a state Safe Routes to School program. We're not asking that you include the funding portion of the bill that would have dedicated the current sales tax paid on bicycles and bicycle parts. But we'd like to think, like you to think of this program, as Jody said, as safe routes for everyone. It would focus on projects that would help make walking and bicycling the safe and easy alternative. The idea to create the state-level active transportation program is not coming from the urban core. It's coming from communities throughout the state. The handout that I shared with you shows the members of the Minnesota Mayoral Active Transportation Caucus. I think if you look at it, both sides, many of your mayors are on that list. They see good walking and biking as an asset that will keep their community and their residents healthy. It will help them attract and retain young people, young families, and businesses. And communities throughout the state are doing this with their own money and their own paint and signs, but they need a little help with big projects like a bridge over a county or state highway, a user-activated crosswalk, or a trail connection from the edge of town into downtown so people can enjoy the amenities in the downtown area. The federal funds that MnDOT allocates don't come close to this need. And surveys, including MnDOT's omnibus survey, show that about three-quarters of Minnesotans support the idea of including walking and bicycling in future transportation projects. So that's a big percentage of our state's population. So on behalf of the Minnesota Mayoral Active Transportation Caucus, Minnesotans for Healthy Kids and the Bicycle Alliance, and many others, we hope you will support the amendment that Representative Howe intends to offer today.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I appreciate that. Next we have Sherry. Do we have one questions? Okay. Next we have Sherry Munyon, followed by Bentley Graves. If they could come forward, please. Is Sherry Munyon here? Okay, we'll maybe get to her later. Mr. Graves, you're up. And that's followed by Jason George, if you would like to come forward, too. Thank you, Mr. Graves. Please identify yourself for the committee, and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm here today representing both the chamber, but also a broader stakeholder group of folks interested in getting a long-term comprehensive transportation bill passed this session. A one-page is being handed out. I know this is going to look familiar to most of you as we as a group have met with a lot of you, but this is a group representing business, labor, the transportation industry, ag. It includes us as the chamber, the operating engineers, Minnesota's AGC, the Labor's Union, the Business Partnership, the Carpenters, Greater MSP, Summit Academy, Minnesota Intercounty Association, the Council of Engineers, the Transportation Alliance, and AgGrow. And the work that we've been doing this session is trying to kind of help lay the groundwork again for the passage of the long-term comprehensive transportation bill. There are certainly a number of elements of, you know, our proposal or what we suggested to policymakers in House File 861. In particular, we appreciate the bill's use of the transportation-related revenues, sales tax revenues currently coming to the general fund and dedicating those to transportation. We also, though, have looked for a way to ensure that we get broad bipartisan support behind a long-term transportation funding bill, and we think there's value in coupling those general fund resources with resources that are constitutionally dedicated. Our suggestion has been to look at a change in the TADF depreciation schedule. We note that House File 861 kind of begins us at least down that path to some extent with the change in registration fees due on electric vehicles. We appreciate that policy move and would encourage more conversation about the larger conversation around TADF fees as well. We also think that efficiencies ought to continue to be a part of this, and we appreciate the dealing with efficiencies in the bill, but we would like to see, if possible, some of that language tightened up to ensure that MnDOT is able to make good on its commitment to provide 15% efficiencies on the new revenues coming in, and we can track that over time. We support trunk highway bonding and certainly note the sizable trunk highway bonding piece of this bill and the various uses for that. And we've also made it clear that, you know, a transportation funding bill has to provide for both roads and bridges and transit, and that's transit of greater Minnesota, but also transit in the metro area. This bill doesn't do much to address the shortfall in the budget for bus operations, both metro mobility and regular bus in the metro area, and that's a conversation we'd like to continue to carry forward with the chairman and with others. The bus system is the backbone of the transit system in the metro area, and we want to make sure that we're making the investments necessary there. And also, Mr. Chairman, we at the Chamber and in this coalition have advocated for a metro funding solution to the build-out of the transit system in the metro area. And this coalition in particular has supported the move by the counties to take ownership of that system, both in building it and operating it. And we're very concerned about the change in this bill that would forestall any of that progress going forward. The build-out of the transit system is important, particularly to many of our members in the business community. We'd like to continue that conversation, again, with the chair and others, because we see it as an important link in the state's multimodal transportation infrastructure. And we think that the county should be able to go ahead and take that ownership on and move the ball forward with the build-out of that system. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Jason Dord from the 49ers, who's part of this coalition as well, my colleague, and then Abby Breidick from AGC will offer a few comments as well. Thank you for the time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And, Mr. George, please continue, and Abby Breidick is next after that.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Jason George with the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 49. We represent about 14,000 heavy equipment operators in the state. Our members build your infrastructure in conjunction with several other different construction trades. I do support all of the comments made by Mr. Graves. We are working in coalition with the Minnesota Chamber Business Partnership, our contractors you see sitting next to me right now. I won't wade into the policy. I think Mr. Graves laid that out very well, and again support his comments. I'm just here with a plea. We've been waiting as an industry, workers, contractors, many of whom, almost all of our 800 signatory contractors are small business owners, 20 employees or less throughout the state of Minnesota, every corner, to get this done this year. We've waited and waited, different political environments, different people in control. We seem to only get lights on bills and one-time fixes, and nothing seems to happen long-term. We are here to ask you to do something this year long-term that puts us in a good place going forward for the next 10 years. We won't get everything that everybody wants. And those of us that are in labor unions understand you don't always get, you never get everything that you want. So we're really asking you all, Republicans and Democrats, to come together and figure out something that can pass, get to the governor for his signature, and move us forward as a state. I want to thank the chairman. I believe that the proposal you put forward is a very serious proposal and a very good first step to help us move in that direction. I'm very encouraged that you all are starting these discussions early as opposed to waiting till May. That's also something that we support. So, I just have a plea. Get this done this year. And please do that for the tens of thousands of workers that make their living in this industry and the small business owners that do as well. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And before Ms. Braddock gets started, I want to say Peter Laughlin is next. And then we're going to have a slight change. We, in error, omitted Met Council. So Judge Chittenden would be after Peter McLaughlin as well. So Ms. Braddock, please welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair members. My name is Abby Breidick, and I represent the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. We are Minnesota's oldest construction trade association. Our members are comprised of general contractors, subcontractors, material suppliers, and other construction-affiliated industries. I'd like to just mention that I stand behind the comments that were made on behalf of our one-pager coalition, and we've enjoyed meeting with all of you to discuss the concepts behind that proposal. I want to just make a point, and as we come to you not just from a jobs perspective, but the construction companies that we represent are really on the front lines of project delivery for the state. And because of that, we believe that we have a lot to offer as, in terms of how to get the most value out of our construction dollars and how to provide those projects most efficiently. One of the most important elements of providing efficient projects is that we have stable funding sources, that we know what's coming down the pike, that we can invest in our workforce properly in that way, and we can plan to use resources and the seasons, upcoming construction seasons, in the best way possible. With that said, again, we believe this is a good start for a bill. We very much appreciated the collaboration we've experienced with the chair, but we would like to see a bit more of an element to that would include some constitutionally dedicated funding, some new revenue, to kind of give us more assurance that we know we can bank on revenue coming in the future. And we also do share the concerns around the transit conversation, the build out of the metro lines, and bus service in the metro and around the state. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And next we have Mr. McLaughlin, followed by Judge Shetner from the Met Council. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself and continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Peter McLaughlin. I'm Hennepin County Commissioner and Chair of the County's Transit Improvement Board, the five-county joint powers board that was authorized by the 2008 state transportation legislation, and a former member of this committee way back in the late 1980s. It's great to be back. I appreciate the challenges that you've got in trying to put together an omnibus bill. And I want to talk about how we get to a bill that contains strong investment for the state of Minnesota's future for roads, bridges, and transit. I think on behalf of CTIB, I have to raise some very fundamental policy questions regarding this bill because of the interference with the actions of local elected officials and the promises that those elected officials and the state legislature made to taxpayers in previous legislation and in conjunction with local actions to impose sales taxes. This bill would, just to give you a listing of these policy questions, divert locally imposed sales taxes to meet state obligations, and that's being done at a time of state surplus. It interferes with local government joint powers entities and joint powers agreements, and I think any local government with a joint powers agreement ought to take note that they're not safe if this kind of legislation is passed. Those agreements that they reach with their neighbors could be thwarted, overturned, or misused by legislative action. This bill cuts funding to Met Council particularly for bus service, and it does not deal with the growing need for metro mobility service with our aging population. It eliminates all state funding for light rail transit, but requires state approval for the very same rail projects. Now, that one I would characterize as a mother may I approach, but you're going to require us to pay your bills, and you're going to ask us to take the money out of our college fund that we earned with our paper route. I mean, that's what it is. Mother may I, can we do this, but you got to pay, and we're going to tell you how to do it. So I think that's a fundamental problem that goes against the direction of the 2008 legislation, and it's going to lead to bad outcomes for the state of Minnesota. It ties the hands of the Met Council on the use of COPs. I think this really is bad faith with our local taxpayers. We went to the taxpayers, said we were going to expand the transit system with these sales taxes, and now you're going in the opposite direction. You're not allowing expansion, and we think that is really bad faith with the taxpayers that we share. I would make a couple other points. One, there's this myth of LRT that is somehow inefficient. The fact of the matter is it's carrying 28% of the riders on the LRT, on the transit system in the metropolitan area. It's costing about 21-22% of all the operating costs. It's highly efficient. It's met all its targets for ridership. And these stories about subsidy per ride in the $19 range are wrong. The subsidies are less than $1.80 per ride on the two light rail lines. And so, finally, I just point out one other thing. The payroll, just the payroll, in terms of the state benefit, the state payroll on the Southwest LRT line is going to be over $300 million. That's going to generate more in income, just in income tax on that payroll, It'll pay more than a year's worth of operating subsidy for the state on the Southwest line. Just that payroll, not the goods and services that are bought, the goods and services that are bought that have sales tags on them, and other things in the state that are spun off from this. So, Mr. Chairman, the business community has been strongly supportive of this. Local governments have been strongly supportive of an expansion of the transit system in order to support our economy in the metropolitan area, which is the engine of the state's economy. This will undercut that. It will allow us not to compete. And I think it's a bill that's going in the wrong direction in many ways, and I hope it can be improved. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin. And next we have Judge Hednett. Oh, I'm sorry. Chair Torkelson, before you leave, has a question for you. Representative Torkelson.
Mr. McLaughlin, thank you for being here. I apologize for my voice being not in very good shape.
Mine's not very good either.
Chat with you will be very limited today, but first I want to thank you for coming before us. I know that you're in a very difficult spot at very challenging times, and you probably can't even answer my questions at this point, but what's happening with the CTIP dissolution?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. McLaughlin,
I would say that we have been laboring for 4 or 5 months to try to dissolve CTIP. And that the idea of the dissolution would be that then the member counties would have access to the half-cent sales tax that all the other counties in the state of Minnesota have for transportation purposes. So some of our counties would be able to impose up to a half-a-cent sales tax, and they could use it for roads, bridges, or transit. And some of us would probably be using it primarily for transit. We've been trying to do that. In order to do that, however, it takes a vote of all five county boards who are members of the Joint Powers Agreement. The five counties each voted to join. Each of the five counties have to agree to pull it apart. And Dakota County has been resistant to that. They are looking for a significant payment. They're trying to look back and say that they require a payment to make up for the lack of investments in their county. The fact of the matter is, The 2008 bill, the law, provided for a compensation for those counties that were part of CTIP that didn't get as many transit investments, that in the form of leased vehicle sales tax money that goes to five counties in the metro area but doesn't go to Hennepin and Ramsey. And it didn't go to Hennepin and Ramsey because the thought was we were going to get more investment in transit out of CTIP than these other counties. And so it was designed specifically to compensate for the lack of investment that was likely to happen in these other five counties. So, in fact, now what Dakota wants to do is look back and say, we haven't had as much investment in transit, but they will not and do not, in any of the numbers they presented to any of you, they don't include the $36 million that they will have received by the end of 2017 from leased vehicle money. $36 million, they get another 10 or 11 next year. So, in fact, the policy worked. The counties that were not going to get quite as much investment in transit were going to be compensated by having access to the leased vehicle money that they could use for roads. And so the look back and this demand for last demand that I heard was $33 million plus some policies that were really unacceptable and were going to be impossible to implement. It runs a counter to what was in the legislation and the $36 million that they received in leased vehicle money. So I don't think we're going to dissolve because their demands are excessive and it really isn't a fair deal for the other four counties, all of which have agreed to go forward with the dissolution. So Dakota County is standing in the way. We were trying to get this issue of light rail transit capital from the state off your plate. That's what one of the things we were trying to do, try to get investment money to do that. But Dakota County is standing in the way of that. The other four counties have agreed.
Chair Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. We're giving you quite a platform here, and that's fine. The other big question mark surrounding this issue, of course, is the issue of federal funding. Do you have any current information as to whether or not federal funds are coming your way?
So, Mr. Chairman, sure. Federal funding has been and will continue to be a matter of competition. The Trump administration has said in its budget that there would be no funding out of the capital account for projects that do not yet at this point have a full funding grant agreement. That's the proposed budget. And as you know, the governor proposes a budget, the legislature disposes. The same is true with Congress. And so the Congress will have a say. So it is uncertain at this point. The Trump budget, President Trump's budget, has that policy in it, which would mean that Southwest would not be eligible to get a funding because they don't have a full funding grant agreement right now. But that is subject to the budget negotiations.
Chair Turkles.
Thank you. Are you pursuing a full funding agreement, and do you expect that it may be in place anytime soon?
Commissioner?
And I might defer here to the Met Council because they're actually in charge of this, but the intention is to make application for the full funding grant agreement within the year, before this year is out, and then it would go through the federal process.
Chair
Thank
Turkles.
You. That's all for me, Mr. Chair. I know others may have questions. I hope we can keep it short.
Representative Renbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here, Mr. McLaughlin. Your comments today about LRT for the future. I mean, I'm reading things in your documents that say the two that are on the drawing board are probably the last two, and yet I don't hear that. I hear today that it sounds like you still want to continue to do more LRT. And my point is $124 million a mile is what Southwest Light Rail is. Those construction costs are not figured into any of the operating costs, which you tout as being so efficient. So clearly it's the most expensive model out there, the most expensive mode we can do. And I'm curious, our statute on CTIB actually reads that your number one priority is to maximize the uses and opportunities for federal funding. How much has that statute influenced your decisions to do light rail without really taking a close look at anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Runbeck. On every line, and I'll go back to the green line connecting Minneapolis and St. Paul as the best example, but the same thing is true on Southwest. You have to do an alternatives analysis. You have to look at not doing anything. You have to look at buses, and you have to look at investment in rail. That there was an extensive examination of that on both Southwest and the green line. And the conclusion, and also on the Gateway Corridor that goes east, would go east from downtown St. Paul out I-94. And that one, the recommendation was a busway. And so we've looked, the local communities have looked, CTIB has looked, and we say in certain corridors it makes sense to invest in LRT, in the highest density corridors. In other corridors, if other issues arise, like on, say, 35W, it's a busway that's going in there. But there is the best alternative. The conclusion was clearly the best alternative connecting St. Paul and Minneapolis was an LRT line because of the huge volumes. And the same is true in the Southwest Corridor. Chasing the money is not what's going on here. In the Gateway Corridor, the conclusion was reached that LRT was not warranted. And we are supportive of and are ready to invest in, but for the lack of the state share, we're ready to invest in a busway that would go out past the 3M campus and on into Woodbury. And so we look at it from line to line. The same is true with the Met Council and all of our investments, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner or Representative Runbeck, all of our investments have to be consistent with the Met Council's transportation policy plan. We can't go off on our own. We cannot go off on our own.
Thank you very much.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this could be to both testifiers. Especially, I'm going to focus on the LRT. And, again, you've made some really good comments about how efficient it is and why we have it. And because I operate within within the committee here, where I keep hearing things that, to me, make absolutely no sense outside of this room, is there any place in the world that doesn't believe in rail, light rail, and of those types of options?
Okay. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mason. I think if you look at when I look at the world economy, and we're in a world economy, people say to me, well, your competition is St. Paul. And I say, you're right. In Minneapolis, our big competition is St. Paul, Sao Paulo, Brazil. It's not about St. Paul, Minnesota. we're talking about regions, and the big regions around the world, all of those that are performing well have major investments in transit. They have to have that. And frankly, if you look around this country, there have been major investments, not just in places that you might think of as liberal bastions on the West Coast, but we're talking about Maricopa County, that's Phoenix, Arizona, Salt Lake City, Utah, Dallas, Texas. Dallas, Texas has more miles of LRT than any region in the United States of America. Texas, okay? And so I think in terms of regions that are performing well, they are investing in their transit system and in rail transit. And if you listen to the greater MSP and some of the other business advocacy groups, they think it's a critical component to have a transit system that works so that they can attract business, attract the workers that they need for their businesses to prosper, and thereby allow our region to prosper. That's really what's going on. We think this. I'm not anti-road. We got a lot of roads in Hennepin County, and we've been supportive of investment in roads and bridges. I've replaced, in my time on the county board, we have replaced 4 bridges across the Mississippi River, county bridges. So I mean, we're not shirking our responsibility. We're not shortchanging our roads and bridges, but we think transit and rail transit in the right corridors is actually the right investment to be made, and we're going to keep pursuing that because we think that's how we're going to be competitive with these other regions that have transit.
They do things big in Texas.
I appreciate that. Mason. Thank you.
Thank you, and I think we do need to continue on with our testimony. Oh, we have one more, and then that's going to be the last one of this test fire. Representative Kosnick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner McLaughlin, you'd mentioned the motor vehicle lease tax and that being an offset for not having as many projects in a particular county. Mm-hmm. Are there counties receiving motor vehicle lease tax that are not in CTIB?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cosby. Yes, Scott and Carver.
Okay, thank you. And as a follow-up, Greater Minnesota Transit is getting, Mr. Chair, I believe is receiving motor vehicle lease tax. Are they in CTIB?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, no.
Representative Kosnick?
How did that come across back in 2008, if you could?
Well,
Commissioner, please.
Mr. Chairman, sorry. I beg your pardon.
Go ahead.
This was the day the bill was up, okay, in 2008 for passage in the House, I walked into the Capitol, and I was told that the Dakota County was going to pull its votes for the transportation bill of 2008 unless they got this leased motor vehicle. And the idea was that it was going to compensate for those counties that weren't going to get left. And the original formula that was agreed to initially was that Hennepin and Ramsey would actually would receive some of the leased vehicle money in the metropolitan area. And we'd have to subtract, it was a population-based formula, and we'd have to subtract the population of Minneapolis and Bloomington, and St. Paul would have to subtract out the population of St. Paul. And Scott and Carver, they were eligible to join CTIB, so putting them in the mix of in making all 7 counties eligible, that made sense at the time because we didn't know who was going to be in. So a day later, day and a half later, we get the word, no, that deal's off. We accepted that deal because we had a gun at our head, essentially. Day and a half later, we were informed that no, Hennepin and Ramsey would receive nothing. And so we received zero. In Hennepin, zero in Ramsey, and the other counties have received a significant amount of money. Dakota, in particular, having received $36 million by the end of this year. That's how it came about. It was a last second agreement that was reached, frankly, out in front of the chamber doors in the House.
Representative Kosnick, do you have a brief follow up?
No, I'll let it be at that. It's just interesting that I think it's a little unclear to single out Dakota County solely as holding out, but we've got other counties that are receiving motor vehicle lease tax, and other areas of the state are receiving motor vehicle lease tax. So I hope that there is some kind of resolution shortly for CTIB, Mr. McLaughlin, but I think it's important for the committee to note why the lease tax was originally intended for those counties to offset. I would agree with you there, to offset the lack of transit projects in those counties. Thank you.
We do need to continue on. Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin. If anybody has more questions of the commissioner, I'm sure he's available after the committee meeting here.
Absolutely. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Shittenden, you are up next. Please identify yourself. Continue with your testimony. Welcome.
Great. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Judd Shittenden, the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. We're here to testify in House File 861. I appreciate being moved up and being put on the list. The this bill does a few things. There's a lot of policy in this bill, but I want to speak to the finance first. What this bill does is that it leaves the Metropolitan Council or Metropolitan Area Transit with a $55 million deficit for the state fiscal year 18 and 19 biennium. And that is created because of the reduction of our motor or of our general fund at the growth of the motor vehicle sales tax. And what that does is does not allow us to be able to function the system that we have today. If we were faced with this actual $55 million shortfall, what we would need to do is reduce our regular ridership by about 12%, and it would also be a reduction of about 15 million rides over that biennium, and this is after we would apply an across-the-board quarter fare increase. So these are real and substantial impacts to this bill. What this bill also does is that currently, as I've mentioned to the committee in the past, we fund Metro Mobility through the general fund, and we've been hoping that the state would continue to go that way because Metro Mobility is a federal and state-mandated program that we have to provide. There is a call on that off the top. Your bill reflects that as well. And so what happens is if we shift the Metro Mobility over to MVEST, we've showed you the map that shows how Metro Mobility is growing at 8% a year. What happens there is when all we have left is MVEST, is that growth consumes all of the motor vehicle sales tax, which means that we have to reduce our regular bus system even further. And what's going to happen there is it's kind of this thing keeps chasing itself around, because while we reduce our regular bus system, it means that those folks who are METMO certified, who can use the regular route bus, are now going to be shifted to Metro Mobility, which has a average fare subsidy of about a ride subsidy of about $23 a piece. And so this is just kind of going around and down and spiraling downward. So that is a major concern. Commissioner McLaughlin did a nice job of explaining the shift that is going from the CTIB group to the council to cover our transitway expenses. That is a local option sales tax that was done in order to supplant or to supplement and not supplant our transit service. And so if that wasn't in there, which we don't agree with, our deficit would actually grow by an additional $67 million. So that is troubling. With the bill, there are a number of policy provisions in here that I'd like to touch on. And Mr. Chair, I know you want to move quickly. So there is a letter, I believe, that was distributed to the members. I hope the members were able to receive it. If you didn't, I'll give a copy here in a minute. I sent it earlier this morning. But there are provisions from a number of House files that I just want to mention. I won't go through all of it because I spent a lot of time talking about this in committee earlier. But Representative Rumbach's House File 418 that basically stops cities, counties, regional rail authorities of the council from planning, studying, designing, constructing light rail. We do not support that at all. We think it usurps local planning, and it also has big consequences for the Southwest Line. The House File 1150 is Representative Uglum's bill that relates to the fare box recovery goal for our transportation policy plan of 40%. We don't set fare policy in our transportation policy plan. Also, there is a federal process that we have to follow in order to raise fares. And so, as I mentioned earlier, we are in the process of conducting our hearings to look at how we would raise fares, and I would expect that the council will probably end up there. But what House File 1150 does, it's Article 4, Section 78 and 88. That is where that resides. On Article 4, Section 70, or excuse me, at, excuse me, Article 4, Section 79 is House File 1990, which is Representative Albright's bill that would shift additional funds to the suburban transit providers. I need to remind members, again, this is a zero-sum game. I talked about this at length in committee, but any additional shift that occurs there is a further reduction to our regular bus system in the metro area. And so I would strongly urge the committee to consider that.
You're starting to run out of time, but I'll give you an extra minute.
I'll be fast, all right, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for the accommodation. With that, Mr. Chair, actually the last piece I want to talk about, everything else is in the letter, but it's an Article 4, Section 102 that repeals the provision that establishes the state pay 50% of the operating funds for light rail. I mentioned this before, but I just want folks to recall this, is that the fiscal note on this bill shows no impact because the operations for the Southwest line don't come in this biennium. They don't come in the next biennium. They occur starting in fiscal year 22 and 23. However, our financial outlay that we provide to our federal partners to be able to receive these funds, we have to demonstrate that we have a plan. We operate on current statutory authorities. That's how we built our plan. So while it looks innocuous, in fact, moving forward with this provision would not allow us to pursue that full funding grant agreement that we were mentioning earlier without having an alternative plan. And at this point, we do not. So I'm happy to answer any questions if you'd like. Otherwise, we'll probably get to that later.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Shedden. And please, for the committee, if they have any other questions, you sure can talk to you afterwards.
Thank you again for the accommodation.
Yeah, thank you. And I appreciate those that are keeping their time to 3 minutes. We do have a lot of over 20 testifiers yet. Patrick Baker from Greater Mankato, followed by Bob Carney. If you guys could come down, we appreciate that. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Baker, welcome and identify yourself.
Thank you. My name is Patrick Baker. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Greater Mankato Growth. That is our Chamber of Commerce in Greater Mankato, but I also have the privilege of serving as a board member on the U.S. Highway 14 Partnership Board of Directors, and it is in that capacity that I appear before you today. I want to thank the chair and the committee for including corridors of commerce money within your bill. As you know, that money is the only reason that we've been able to advance construction on further portions of Highway 14 to finally get that connected four lanes from Rochester to New Ulm. We do have two 12-mile segments that are still two lanes that remain. And so in order for us to move forward with that finalization of that highway, we need in the neighborhood of about $300 million, depending on what that construction process looks like. But one thing I want to point out in the bill, I think the corridors of commerce dollars are all generated through bonds. In order for us to use the corridors of commerce money effectively, we need a portion of the corridors of commerce dollars to be in cash. If you look at the project of that $300 million or so, about $40 million needs to be in right-of-way acquisition, about $21 to $30 million in engineering, and the remainder in the actual construction. As I understand it, you cannot use bond proceeds from corridors of commerce to do the right-of-way and the engineering. And so in order for those dollars to be effective in completing Highway 14, we need some portion of it to be in cash to move forward on some of the right-of-way and engineering. So that's my only comment. I want to thank you for including the dollars in there, and hopefully we can put a portion of those into cash so that we can actually do what I think those are intended to do and move forward on some of those critical corridors like Highway 14.
Thank you, Mr. Baker.
Thank you.
Mr. Carney, you're up next, followed by Amity Foster from Isaiah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bogdan Carney, Jr. I'm a registered lobbyist for We the People, an informal association. Kind of in a position to give a little bit of an alternative facts rebuttal to Chair of CTIP McLaughlin and the Met Council.
You have 3 minutes.
Yep.
Use it wisely.
I have to say that McLaughlin ran about 19 on my count, but that's fine. I don't know. Yeah, you set the 3 minutes, and I'm using too much of it.
He responded to questions.
That's
so
right.
That's
your
right. Testimony.
And I'm very happy to do that, too. The first point that McLaughlin made was that this promise was made by the legislature. Well, the fact is, unless something's in the Constitution, a legislature cannot make promises for subsequent legislatures. Let's be clear about that. This thing was launched in 2008 with a quarter cent sales tax. Let's see how it's going to work. At that point, light rails were running about $1 billion, and they're approaching $2 billion. That system is not working at all. And so the reaction to this financial disaster and now obsolete technology is the responsibility of this legislature. talking about promises, Adam Dunick, the chair of the Met Council, said that he wasn't going to use certificates of participation. When it became clear they couldn't move forward, Governor Dayton literally said he overruled him at a news conference after his meeting. Now, where are we at in terms of the constitutional system of government, where you have a governor, an executive branch official, ordering non-elected administrative personnel to make policy? So a couple things to consider there. I will be following up on a couple questions that came up in the testimony on the insurance issue regarding railroads. I will be following up with some written material on that. But the bottom line, when you're looking at the big picture here, the Met Council's 5-20-40 plan, and these are alternative facts from them. They're talking about spending $31 billion in the metro area from 2015 to 2040 on what they call transit. And a lot of that includes fare box recovery. It includes operating and capital. When you run the fare box recovery number, they have about $5 billion in anticipated fare box revenue. Their fare box recovery is actually 15%. Around the 1950s, when transit systems were primarily private sector, it used to be 100%. We have a totally unsustainable system, and we need to start thinking about building a 21st century system and getting away from this idea that 19th century mass transit is our solution going forward into a system, a century of automated everything. That's where we're headed. And the concerns about the financing, the buses are very real, but what this really boils down to is that this determination to push ahead at all costs with light rail, in effect, is holding bus service hostage to light rail. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carney. I appreciate your testimony. Next, we have Amity Foster from the IZA Group, I believe. Please identify yourself and welcome to the committee.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Amity Foster. I am a member of IZEA. I'm also here with Transportation Forward. So I live in Northeast Minneapolis, and I am one of the transit-reliant riders that you hear about all the time. I don't drive, both out of choice and because of a medical condition. Public transportation is what makes it possible for me to participate fully. I want to give you all an idea of my transit reality. So I take the bus to the train to downtown Minneapolis, then I take the train to work, take the train down here to the Capitol. Tonight I'm going to take the train to a phone bank. Last night I took the train to downtown Minneapolis and then a bus to a meeting in South Minneapolis. Sometimes I have to run errands, so there's a bus trip or two to Target or to the quarry in Northeast. The amount of grocery bags that I've carried on public transit, I should be much stronger than I am right now. The other thing that I want you to know, though, about that reality, I am spending more time and more money in my community. My relationships, my networks have extended because of public transportation. I would not be here if it were not for public transit, for the bus. I am connected to the people that I love. Without well-funded transit, my community drastically narrows. When I say it narrows, it means that I would not leave Northeast Minneapolis. That's not because I don't want to. That's because of the shame and the embarrassment that I have when I have to call a friend and say, hey, I need to get over to Northside. Can you pick me up? I shouldn't have to do that. We shouldn't have a state where people are ashamed to get around and out into their community, and that's what we are building right now. We need to invest new money in buses, rail, biking, and walking options. If we do not, we are disinvesting in our state. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next, we have Mel Reeves, and followed by Emily Pugh. Is Mel Reeves here? And Emily Pugh, if you want to come down, and you can come down at the same time if you'd like. Welcome, Mr. Reeves. Please identify yourself and continue with your testimony.
My name is Mel Reeves. And like Amity, I actually transportation independent. I'm glad that you all gave me an opportunity to come and talk to you. Unfortunately, a lot of folks who disagree with your proposed bill can't come down and talk to you this evening. They're working. If they came down, they would have to depend on some of the same system that you all are thinking about cutting. I didn't write too many things down because I actually wanted to look at you all as I was talking to you, because I recognize that, you know, you all are, you know, this is the House of Representatives, and I think the key part of that representative word means that you represent. And I know you all don't necessarily represent the Twin Cities, all of you, but you represent the state of Minnesota. And so I'm curious as to why you, or what has happened to make you think that parts of the state of Minnesota, the parts of the state of Minnesota that has the highest population, would not be interested in having their busing funded. I don't know if there's anything that's happened, any movement afoot that said that the people who live in Minneapolis and St. Paul, or Hennepin County, and Ramsey County don't want any more service. I'm not aware of that. I'm really curious as to what's going on that you would take away. I looked at the bill, and I noticed there's money for airports out in outstate, small places I can't pronounce. There's money for public safety. There's money for just about everything in that bill. But there's no money for buses in the area in which the most of the people in the state that lives. That doesn't sound right. And then I'm curious. I really am. I almost want to ask you some questions. Is there something about the folks that live in these two major cities? Is the way they walk? Is the way they smell? Is there something going on that you wouldn't fund them? It doesn't make sense to me. Because a lot of people depend on it. And as you heard from the Met Council, it's subsidized. But when you compare it to the other major cities, it's not any worse than any place else. So I suggest that you all go back and actually try to represent all of us. Because a lot of people depend on getting on to work, getting to work, through, like Amity said, just getting around by the bus, getting to work through the bus. It's the only means of transportation for some folks. And maybe that's not your experience. But I'm asking that you all, as representatives of all of us, that you would think about that. And the other thing I think you ought to consider is that, you know, the monies that you all are considering spending here come from all of us. The folks who live in Minneapolis-St. Paul, they put into that pot as well. So shouldn't they also benefit from some of what they put into the pot? I mean, that just makes sense. Only seems fair, especially if this is a body of representatives. So anyway, that's what I want to say, just that you all ought to reconsider this. That's a lot of paper that you got together there, and not to have two lines that say, you know, we're going to give a little money to the poor people who have to catch the bus in Minneapolis-St. Paul, the area with the most people. Something about that doesn't sound right, and I think you ought to change it.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Representative Hausman.
Mr. Reeves, I just wanted to thank you. That was very valuable testimony, and it's a message really that no one else at that microphone has shared with us, and thank you so much for taking the time out.
Thank you, Mr. Reeves. Next we have Emily Pugh, followed by Kent Sulem. Ms. Pugh, please identify yourself for the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Emily Pugh with the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC is a voluntary statewide association representing all of Minnesota's 87 counties. First, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'd also like to thank the committee and Representative Torkelson for making transportation funding a priority. At AMC, one of our top priorities has been to support a comprehensive transportation funding bill that includes new, dedicated revenue for roads, bridges, and transit. AMC has long opposed the shifting of general fund revenue from other parts of the state budget to transportation. We are willing to support dedication of the auto parts sales taxes to transportation as long as there is a surplus and the shift doesn't impact other parts of the budget. We want to thank the author for including $24.7 million for the local bridge replacement program. We appreciate the commitment to the list of bridges that have been waiting for this funding. And we'd also like to offer our support for the $85 surcharge for electric vehicles. In terms of transit, we have concerns with the lack of funding and local control when it comes to deciding what is best for the county, in addition to requiring counties to cover both the capital and operating costs of transit lines. Finally, we have concerns with the policy language that would allow for non-permitted increased weights for milk trucks and trucks hauling construction materials. These increased weights would cause immediate damage to our roads, further deteriorating infrastructure before we have the opportunity or the funding for improvements. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate that. Mr. Sulem, followed by Stephen Huser. Mr. Sulem, please identify yourself and continue on, and welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. There have been a number of testifiers already talking about good things in the bill and concerns of the bill. I am going to highlight the one part of the bill that we are very happy about, and that is the amount of bonding towards local bridges and roads. That is something that will be a benefit. It's also something that is essentially one-time funding. Let me point out the 56,000 miles of things missing in this bill, and that'd be township roads. There's nothing that creates specific funding for us. We do have our 46% of the 5% of the set aside of the portion of funds going to the Highway User Trust Fund. When all is said and done, and I believe, Mr. Chair, you were with Chair Torkelson and I and the fiscal staff yesterday afternoon, that confirming that that amounts to approximately $7.9 million for town roads. That's less than we got 10 years ago in the last bill. That was only a portion of the funding. It's only a third, or just barely over a third, of the $20 million in need that we have above and beyond current funding for just our current maintenance levels. That's not to improve the roads to accommodate the heavier trucks that are being authorized with the weight limit provisions in the bill, and I do thank Representative Baker for working with us and trying to make that a little more palatable. Not quite there where we can embrace it, but I do appreciate the efforts that we're doing. It's been a very good conversation. And so I just simply want to leave it that prior testifier said that we have to get it done this year. We need the transportation bill this year, which is absolutely true. It's taking about 10 years per transportation bill. Today happens to be my 50th birthday. At the rate we're going, I've got one more bill left in me, sir. So. All right? Let's get this one done, but we got to get it done right, and that includes the town roads that are not funded in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next, please identify yourself or the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Huser. I represent Metro Cities. Metro Cities represents 91 cities in the 7-county metropolitan area. Thank you for the opportunity to share Metro Cities' positions on provisions in the amended House File 861. I will touch on provisions of interest in the bill to Metro Cities, as well as some concerns the association has with this bill. Metro Cities supports provisions in the bill to aid cities in addressing local street needs. We appreciate the increase to the municipal street aid base included in House File 861. This amount will help to address a portion of the city street need. Metro Cities will continue to support a higher level of funding to comprehensively address local street needs for cities in the region and state. While we appreciate that small city account funding is included in this bill, Metro Cities continues to support the creation and funding of a large city account to aid cities over 5,000 in population with non-MSA portions of their street systems. We also continue to support sustainable, ongoing funding for these accounts. Metro Cities respectfully opposes Article 4, Section 76. This provision prevents a city in the metro area from spending any funds to study, develop, or construct any light rail project without legislative authorization for the project. Metro Cities policies support local control and decision-making authority. This provision would restrict local processes that local officials use, currently provided for in law, in undertaking light rail projects. These are lengthy public processes that include community engagement and require the commitment and participation of the local unit of government. These types of projects begin at the local level, and this provision would eliminate the ability of local officials to appropriately engage in the undertaking of such projects. Metro City's policy supports the sustainable and full funding of all modes of transportation. That includes road and bridge funding, as well as funding for transit, and is concerned with the provisions in the bill that have implications for the provision of funding for transit and transit operations. Metro Cities policy support funding to meet both operational needs and strategic expansion of the regional transit system. We are concerned that this bill will have a negative impact on the region's transit system operations and expansion. Metro Cities looks forward to working with the committee on these issues as this bill progresses this session. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Next, we have Rachel, and I apologize for the hour back, and then Terry Schneider. Is Rachel here? Okay. All right. Then we'll move on to, thank you for that information. Terry Schneider, next. Followed by Harry Maddox. Go ahead. Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the committee.
Terry Schneider, Mayor of Minnetonka. Two things. I want to just give you a brief background on myself, and then sort of one sort of selfish topic regarding the transit package, and then one broader topic. I've been mayor for 8 years, going on 9. been on the council for 22 years, been involved in many regional activities, including Metro Cities, and was president per year in League of Minnesota Cities. Was on the Transportation Advisory Board for a number of years, and I'm currently serving on the Southwest Light Rail Corridor Management Committee, so you can kind of see where the bias I'm coming from. The selfish part of my comment is that Minnetonka is a reasonably affluent community, but we have an aging community and large lots, and we've had a difficult time getting Met Transit service to serve both our transit dependent community and our auto dependent community that really needs to have that ability to have an option other than driving their car. Years ago, we got special legislation passed to opt out, but opt back in, and so we've been using that to negotiate with Met Council to get better service for our 50,000 residents. And we have 50,000 businesses, employees for businesses that use that same service. The real challenge is it because of the large lot and the layout of our community, it's hard to justify a dedicated single route, you know, morning going down and evening coming in for the kind of rides we need. The Southwest Light Rail provides a huge benefit to our community because it provides a touch point in the community, right adjacent to the community, where we can now negotiate with Met Council to do a circulator route to meet the needs of all those populations without having to justify a dedicated route downtown. It means a whole lot to our community, and that's why our, I say not unanimously, but the vast majority of our community supports the light rail because of that connectivity. Our businesses, we've got the Opus development, if anybody's familiar with it, it's a large industrial park. Somewhat dated because it was office industrial. Now it's developed with the United Health Group, 6,000-some jobs. We have several hundred million dollars worth of investment that's pending to be developed in that area, subject to the light rail coming in. Goes disappear if it doesn't happen. So those are the selfish parts of it. The broader picture is that Minnetonka has been very fiscally conservative, very judicial for many, many years. We pride ourselves in forward thinking, so we try to make sure we're giving the greatest value for the taxes that we collect to our citizenry, and we get reports back on an annual basis when we do our survey that you're doing a great job of giving us good value. Not necessarily the lowest taxes, but good value. By part of that is taking a long-term look. We don't look next year or the year after. We look 10, 20 years from now. We try to figure out what the needs are, what are the changes. We know there's demographic, there's infrastructure, there's all kinds of things. How do we plan for those and budget for those accordingly and make prudent, fiscal, responsible decisions that address those needs as they come up? And so far that's been working very well. Our citizens are engaged. They don't get surprised by anything. They see it coming. They know why we raise taxes for this and that. I would suggest that is the secret of good government, and it should be the secret of good government at this level as well. Take a long-term look, and when we're talking about the Southwest Light Rail, yes, it's an expensive little train, but it's for a 100-year investment, and it actually goes every 10, 15 minutes all day long where a bus can't do it. It allows us to connect to that, so it's just got some tremendous activities that really provide a full change in character to our city and much more flexibility for where we're going. So bottom line is the provisions you've got in there on section 75, 76, 81, and 80 that basically strip all the ability for cities to control their destiny running to Southwest Light Rail and not allow a true engagement in figuring out what the best alternatives are for all kinds of communities in the metro area. It's not just Minneapolis-St. Paul, it's all of us. I think is a disservice to our citizens and our residents and to the state.
Thank you. And Mr. Mayor, I think we have a brief question from Representative Rinbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Petersburg. And Mr. Schneider, thanks for being here. Does the City of Minnetonka have dollars committed to the project in some way or fashion, or will they be for committing dollars?
Mayor? We have several dollars. We've voted unanimously to commit to $2 million when we went through the issue of the light rail corridor and sort of getting these things resolved from a cost standpoint. We committed that we would devote $2 million to the Southwest Light Rail as our contribution. In addition to that, we've got all the infrastructure commitment in place to modify roads, put in the right infrastructure, do redevelopment. Now, to be honest with you, we'll get that paid back with development fees, so it's not like a net loss, but we've dedicated I would say close to $3.5 million over time because of light rail, because we know it's going to enhance our community.
All right. Thank you very much.
And thank you for your testimony. Next we have Harry Maddox, followed by Kathy Velasquez. Mr. Maddox, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the committee and share your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee. My name is Harry Maddox. I stay at 4521 Minnehaha Avenue South, South Minneapolis. Upon still hearing about this bill, the 861 and the 14 and, you know, all these, the 1150 bill, I'm still a little troubled because I still look over the bill, and what stands out to me as actually using the system, not as a person writing and, well, I feel like you deserve this, as someone using the system. This looks like an attack on us. If I look around the Mankato, they don't have the same provisions. St. Cloud doesn't have the same provisions. DTA and Duluth doesn't have the same provisions. So what just suddenly made the metro the target area? We're not good enough. We look funny. I mean, the same thing I echo as Brother Mel Reeves. What is this attack on us? Do some of y'all know that we have to ride the bus because some of us can't drive because we have seizures? So if I was to take and put my money into a car instead of putting it into a bus card or putting it into the fare box, then guess what I do? I put millions of people at jeopardy when I get on the road and drive. Nobody is analyzing this. We're just taking the steps and measures to just go ahead and appropriate these bills that attack people. And some of the people still to this day don't know that this is going on, that we still have to get out and tell people that your service is under attack. How does that sit with people? Not all of us can get in our car when we get done with work, drink a couple of cups of coffee, have lunch, jump on 94 and go home. A lot of us have to take trains and buses and connect. This is timely, as if the system hasn't been restrained already. My question is, what's the point in attacking us? We're normal like you. Some of us work just like you too. So my question would be, we're not good enough? I mean, are we separate from the state of Minnesota? I hear outstate, I hear metro. Are we different? Different Minnesota? I mean, I don't get it. Can someone offer me an answer that can conclude why we're not good enough, that our system gets cut? And oh, by the way, Becker receives a system, Becker County, any other place, everybody's doing these mergers and getting fully funded, but yet we're the bull target now. We get slashed because somebody doesn't like the light rail. Good. Doesn't affect us, so you think. Because you don't want to fund this, or you have an issue with a certain part of the metro, you don't want to fund that. And Representative Runbeck, my question to you is, when you proposed this bill and you made all these slashes, did you attempt to, for 10-5 minutes, look into how it affects people? Do you ride the bus? Have you been out there where these buses go? Have you been out there and seen the people? Have you been out there? I'm always out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Maddox. Appreciate your testimony. Representative Mason.
Thank you. Just a quick comment. I do want to thank the testifier. I can't answer your questions. You're going to have to go to the other side for that, but I appreciate your comments.
Thank you, Ms. Representative Mason. Please identify yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Chair Torkelson, committee members. My name is Kathy Velasquez-Everhart. I'm a resident of St. Paul and was grateful to be able to take the bus here and make use of transit. But I'm here today as a member of Citizens Acting for Rail Safety, and we're an all-volunteer advocacy group that brings an informed citizen voice to bear on issues associated with high-hazard freight trains operating throughout Minnesota. And we were formed in particular in response to an exponential growth of oil and ethanol transportation throughout the state. I'm here today to speak to several items in the omnibus bill that are related to rail safety. First of all, I would commend you for the inclusion in Section 82 of information of standards to be developed on co-location between the light rail and hazardous trains, and appreciate seeing those additional safety standards in this. Secondly, something that is that we don't see in the bill, I believe, Chair Torkelson, that you had authored a House file 1465 that included a number of provisions for rail safety earlier in the session, and there are a number of important things in that that carry the conversation of rail safety forward from conversations we had in previous years, in particular funding for railroad oil and hazardous materials emergency preparedness. That is at this moment scheduled to expire in July of this year. There are several things that funding covers, including that would include additional rail inspectors and emergency preparedness for specific neighborhoods. We would hope that some of that could be included or at least carried forward in the future legislation this session. The last thing that I wanted to touch on is Section 85 that is talking about liability for the area that includes the Southwest Light Rail. Colleagues of mine have spoken to this issue in other hearings, so I won't go through it too heavily, but wanted to just emphasize a few key points. One, that the idea of giving a private company limits to liability in the event of a catastrophic loss is something that is not otherwise done, other than it's often shown that the North Star example was done in the past. We feel that that was an exception that doesn't fit the situation now that there's the exponential growth of unit trains carrying oil and ethanol. And so, in short, given that the risk is higher, we can sympathize with the railroad, with TC&W, the freight rail, that their risk is higher, but it seems counterintuitive to be limiting liability, limiting responsibility, when in fact the risks are higher. The second is to point out that this really is about protecting the railroad and not Minnesotans, not the public. We do know that railroads are and should be responsible for the adverse effects that they have on their routes, and because they are responsible, they have established certain self-imposed safety measures. But this provides, limiting that liability creates a perverse incentive for railroads to relax those safety measures as their exposure to risk is reduced. The things that we would encourage if we are going to provide a liability cap would be to secure some meaningful safety commitments that would impact, that would help and benefit these communities. Things like a 10-mile-per-hour speed restriction, reduced length of high-hazard freight, minimum of two-person crew, and so forth. And finally, I would just add that even though this is restricted to a particular area, the impact is likely to reach all of Minnesota, in that there are a good 60,000 residents that live in this area that is included in the liability-free zone, and yet the cost could likely be borne by all taxpayers if indeed a catastrophe that could happen between freight and light rail were to occur. So in closing, I just encourage you to consider removing this liability cap, or at a minimum to add meaningful safety commitments to be required in order to achieve those.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Commissioner Doman, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the committee and continue on with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, Chair Torkelson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mona Doman. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. First of all, I'd like to thank you for your support of the work that we do at the department. I respect and appreciate the difficult decisions you're faced with in meeting your targets as you work on this budget. I understand there are compelling and competing interests for funding. Public safety is one of government's core functions. DPS is its state agency with primarily local impact. We assist our public safety partners across the state as we respond to the needs of the people that you all represent. I hope that you will reconsider and fully support and fund our budget proposal as originally presented. These strategic investments support the communities you represent and the ones that we serve.
It is money well spent, in my opinion, to keep Minnesotans safe, and that is our core mission. We strive to provide timely and efficient service to all Minnesotans and to our stakeholders. Thank you for supporting our requests to increase the spending authority out of the special revenue account to cover the ongoing maintenance cost for our driver license testing system, support for the ongoing maintenance of the statutorily required crash record system, and the Minnesota State Patrol helicopter. Additionally, I appreciate your support of the Public Safety Officer Benefit Program, Officer Health Benefits, and the Soft Body Armor Reimbursement Funding. There are key investments that we propose that are not included in House File 861 that are very concerning. House File 861 only funds MNLAR's operation for 1 year, with funds from the Driver and Vehicle Services Special Revenue Accounts. This is concerning because ongoing funding is needed for ongoing maintenance and support and future enhancements and program changes. Several pieces of legislation being heard this year require funding out of these special revenue accounts, and I'm concerned and believe that those accounts cannot support all of these requests in totality. We began to roll out MNLARS in 2016. I really want to emphasize here that we are not asking for additional dollars for development of the system. Our request is for an ongoing funding source to maintain the system. Without it, the department will be limited in the ability for future enhancements requested by stakeholders and this legislature. If a funding source is not secured, we will have to use development dollars for changes in the system, and this will leave the entire project in jeopardy. A funding source is critical for this key backbone system that the state relies on to issue Minnesota to issue driver licenses and motor vehicle transactions for all Minnesotans. Additionally, we included funding in our budget proposal to support our current operations at current funding levels in our agency. House File 861 does not fully fund this request. Simply put, funding for the agency has not kept pace with rising costs, which jeopardizes our ability to ensure we have enough staff and operating funds to adequately provide our agency required services and support to our public safety partners and the citizens that we all serve. The Department of Public Safety will continue to cover these cost increases through additional vacancies and other cost-saving measures. However, the result will likely include longer wait time for services, delays in projects, delays in inspections, increased turnaround times, and fewer troopers on the road, in addition to reduced trooper academy sizes. We do appreciate this committee's support of the Minnesota State Patrol's Trooper Academy and our efforts on recruitment. The language in House File 861 requires an increase in cadet wages, but differentiates between our Law Enforcement Training Opportunity Program, or what you have heard us talk about before, the LEADO program, at 80% of base salary, and traditional cadets at 100% of base salary. We prefer that all cadets be treated equally, which will also assist in our recruitment efforts. Thank you again for hearing my testimony. Thank you for your support, and I ask you reconsider your budget and fund our budget proposal as we originally presented. I do remain, and my agency remains, committed to working with all of you, Mr. Chair and members, throughout the budget session.
Thank you, Commissioner, for taking time, and I'm sure if we have more questions, we sure can contact you later.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Next, we have Luther Winder and Aaron Daly. Hopefully I said your names right. Close enough, maybe? Please identify yourself with the committee and continue on. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Luther Winder. I'm the Executive Director. You're almost there. Executive Director for Minnesota Valley Transit Authority, also a member of STA, Suburban Transit Association. I'd like to thank and pass on my thank you support, obviously, from this particular committee, as well as from Representative Albright for the inclusion of his two bills in this particular House File 861. I want to just mention that I started my career in paratransit, and I witnessed firsthand how life-changing it was to provide transit service. Transit service gives every citizen the ability to access opportunities and live their lives. Now, prior to the demonstration project, there was no viable way, as I've talked about before, for individuals in the regional system to access employment opportunities in Scott County. I actually reside at Burnsville Transit Center, and I see every day new faces and tired feet as these individuals come from work. So really, I've wanted to do myself the last couple of days. I've really been downstairs asking, you know, what you do before this route? Where do you live? And I hear things like, oh, I live in Brooklyn Park. I live in St. Paul. And I say, well, where did you work at prior? I couldn't find a job. Well, where do you work at now? I work at Amazon. Where do you work at now? I work at Mystic Lake Casino. Does this route benefit you? Do you have a car in your residence? And a lot of times I hear no, or we have one car, or it's price prohibitive for us, for my wife or my spouse, to drive me obviously from Brooklyn Park or from St. Paul all the way to that job that they were able to find in Shakopee. So I want to thank the support of this particular body, and I want to continue to say that suburban providers want to continue to work with you as well as with the council. But we do recognize there are still regional needs that need to be met, but they are part of the regional system. And our standpoint, this actually is very beneficial to us and our riders, and I think they'll thank you as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weiner. I appreciate your testimony. I think you have one question. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You can imagine your testimony is a little bit salt in the wound, in a gaping wound. I don't know if you've been in the room to hear other testimony for the parts of the system that are being dramatically cut. And they have no option. They see no option. The person you talked to, they're those people. They're those people that you talked to who needed to get to work. And the great frustration we have who represent that portion of this region simply don't understand how we ended up with winners and losers in transit, that a few of your lines get new money while the rest of the system serving masses of people is diminished. I so wish that all of us who have an understanding of the need for public mass transit could be working together in an equitable way as we move the system forward.
Representative Hausman, was that a question?
It's a statement.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Hausman. Appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Winder, for your testimony. Appreciate that.
Okay.
Next, we have Aaron Daly. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair. For those here, thank you also for being in attendance. My name is Aaron Daly, and I'm here today representing the Sierra Club, our local North Star chapter, which deals with residents all across Minnesota, as well as the Land Use and Transportation Committee specifically, of which I'm the chair here in Minneapolis. As we all know, transportation is a critical component of Minnesota's economy and quality of life. It holds incredible implications and opportunity for issues of equity and access, as we've heard today, public health, respect for our environment, economic growth. And we really need smart investment and a well-balanced, long-term, sustainable funding solution for transportation in order to ensure a solid future in all of those areas. Transportation is also a major source of air pollution in Minnesota. According to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the transportation sector is responsible for approximately half of the sulfur oxide pollution, half of the nitrogen oxide pollution, and a quarter of the greenhouse gas pollution released in Minnesota each year. We can't afford to let those figures keep rising, and we really need a transportation plan that encourages healthier modes of travel for our residents as well as our environment. Over time, prioritizing a strong transportation network that includes alternatives to driving will help us to grow our economy, create jobs, and attract workers in our state, as well as reduce pollution in our air and water. Multimodal investments are crucial, whether you're looking at procurement and workers making buses in St. Cloud, all the way down to professionals working and trying to access downtown, or low-income communities who can't afford a vehicle or are dealing with medical barriers and have seen a historic level of insufficient investment in crucial transit systems that connect them to the broader metro as well as the state economy. The governor has proposed a forward-thinking investment in the transit infrastructure of the Twin Cities region, and we are disappointed that this proposal isn't included in the bill, and we see it as a significant missed opportunity. House File 861 actually creates unnecessary new barriers to transit investments, as we've heard plenty of here this afternoon, requiring local governments to assume all responsibility for transitway operation while also imposing a restriction on the use of any local dollars for light rail without explicit legislative approval, even when zero state dollars are being used. While we strongly believe that it is in the best interest of the state to actively invest in modes of transportation beyond driving, it really just gets down to alternatives. In the absence of such support, the very least that the legislature could do is to remove and not add barriers to local communities making their transportation infrastructure choices. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate that. Next, we have Cameron Slick and Ann Finn. If you could come down. Is Cameron Slick here? He'll be late. Okay, we'll put him towards the end. Thank you. Ann Finn and then Jason Gadd. Ann Finn, welcome to the committee.
Please identify yourself. Mr. Chair and members, thank you. My name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. We are a statewide association of 833 of Minnesota's 853 cities. I want to thank Chair Torkelson for his work on this bill, also for meeting with us and allowing us to give the committee a briefing earlier in the session. Thank you for taking our testimony today. Minnesota cities, large and small, rural, urban, and suburban, support passage of an omnibus transportation funding bill that is comprehensive, multimodal, and sustainable. Unfortunately, we do not feel that the delete all amendment to House File 861 accomplishes this criteria in its entirety. I want to raise 3 points today. First is that, as you learned earlier this session, the League's highest transportation priority is to secure a dedicated funding source for city streets that are not eligible for municipal state aid under the constitutional formula. These streets exist in both large and small cities. Currently, 84% of the city street system is funded with property taxes and special assessments. According to the 2012 TFAC report, the annual investment needed to bring city streets to an economically competitive condition is $400 million per year over the next 10 years. The base appropriation for the small cities assistance account that this bill provides is appreciated, and we believe it will yield meaningful results. However, our preferred option for funding city streets is the bill that you heard last week, authored by Representatives Hornstein, Gunther, and Hausman. And that bill is supported by all the city groups. It would provide $57 million per year in dedicated revenues to assist large and small cities with street maintenance and reconstruction. More than 200 cities have passed resolutions in support of this bill. Secondly, I mentioned property taxes. Money that flows through the constitutional formula disproportionately benefits the state and all of Minnesota's 87 counties. When the state and counties make investments in roads and bridges, there are almost always cost participation obligations for cities and thus their taxpayers. Given that this bill provides limited new transportation money for cities, there is a likelihood that cities will divert funds from their own street systems to meet cost participation obligations in state and county projects. We also recognize that this bill shifts money from the general fund, and we have concerns that this shift may impact aids to cities that come from the general fund. And finally, we have concerns about the prohibition on spending to study, plan, design, or construct a light rail transit line. This provision is in conflict with our longstanding principle in support of local decision making. We stand ready to work with you to assemble a bill that will benefit all Minnesota communities. And again, we thank you for allowing us to come before you today.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We appreciate that. Jason Gadd and Jeff Strait are next. Welcome to the committee, and if you could please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Sure. Thank you to Mr. Chair and committee members for allowing me to be here. I am Jason Gadd. I serve on Hopkins City Council and have been for the last 6 years. And one of the things I'm proud of in Hopkins is that we enjoy this kind of feedback as well, engaging our residents in hearing what they have to say about different issues. And to me, that's really one of the key components of local government is reaching out to our residents. I do want to say and appreciate, you know, the work that you're doing on creating this omnibus bill, creating a sustained long-term funding option for all kind of forms of transit, roads, bridges, light rail, all that is needed in today's economy, and we need to keep that moving forward. The components that I am opposed to in this bill specifically relate to sections 75, 76, and 81, dealing with taking away the local control over the study and design and building of light rail systems. To me, that is core to what we do as a local government, is we take a look at our infrastructure needs, present proposals to our residents, and engage our residents to get their feedback on what their needs are and what they're looking for. And it's that ability for us to be able to do that study and design work that gives us the confidence to move forward. That's been apparent throughout the entire process with the Southwest Light Rail. As we went through and worked through the locally preferred alternatives, taking a look at what options would be best served our community. And we did take a look at that, looking at our one of our underserved populations around one of the station areas, and that's really where the light rail becomes impacted. And then also taking a look at all the other options, whether what would serve our community in order to allow Hopkins to connect regionally and succeed that way. It's through this public process, that level, that we're able to determine that was the best solution to move forward. And so overwhelmingly support with our residents and businesses, it allowed us to move forward confidently to work with our partners, with the county, regional rail authority, Met Council, and then finally the state to make this a reality. It's that local level and support by residents and businesses that allow us to impact the residents of Hopkins, which are also my neighbors. And so I ask you to remove sections 75, 76, and 81 and maintain the right of local government to control exploring infrastructure options that would be best for our communities.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Council member, I think we do have a question from Representative Renbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gadd, for being here. Can you tell us how much the City of Hopkins is dedicating in funds to support the Southwest Light Rail?
Mr. Gadd?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. One of the things that we have looked at in the city, based on the overwhelmingly support we have for this project, because we are a smaller city, is what we're able to ensure to make this happen, because we see it as a benefit for everybody involved. We have dedicated $500,000 directly to the project, as well as committing city budget dollars to other infrastructure needs to make it happen. One of those, which is being built right now, is the Moline project, which includes, as a part of this development, public parking associated with the light rail station. And so it's enabling and cooperating with all the organizations involved, so that we've committed our own resources to that as well, to make public parking available for the light rail.
Representative
Mr. Chair, a quick follow-up.
Yep.
Mr. Gadd, have you anticipated how much in economic development dollars are likely to occur as a result of Southwest?
Mr. Gadd?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I can tell you, we've already seen an increase of over $300 million in development that's occurring right now because of the project and why they're there. And these projects are coming in town because of people who are looking for, they don't want to have cars anymore. They want to be able to walk to wherever they need to, which includes having access to get to the other parts of the metro. That's just one development in place. We've had, estimating going forward the millions of dollars in development that will impact us. We've just seen the increase in developers that have come to us wanting to research new developments because of the light rail and because of that, adding that multimodal transportation to our city. So it is a direct benefit to us, yes.
Mr. Jeff,
Representative Renbeck, go ahead.
I have one more small follow-up. Sure. So, Mr. Gadd, you were on the council, I presume, when the municipal consent vote was taken.
Correct.
And did it occur to you at the time the cost of this project, and that, in fact, by building it, that you were be passing off half of the operating cost to the state? Was that information that was available to the members at the time?
Mr. Gadd.
I mean, I guess my point is that, that's where this doesn't make sense. It's easy to say yes to a project and have, not a heck of a lot of skin in the game, let's just say. So, were any of those ideas available at the time that you made the decision?
Mr. Gadd.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. I was a part of the committee at that point as well, and that information was available. As far as having skin in the game, as one of the smallest cities along the line, we did have, besides just the financial we accepted the operations and maintenance facility as part of this project, which would be removing over 3% of our operating budget because of the tax base. And so that was removed from our tax base. And so, but because of the overwhelming response from our residents and our businesses through this engagement that we had prior to all the municipal consent, allowing us to spend money to study, that's what enabled us to have that confidence to go forward and understand, you know, this is a part of the overall transit system and overall transportation system, which is not unique to just our city, but it's the regional and statewide benefit of having that, which is part of then working with our partners, whether it be the county in supporting that rail or with the state in helping with the operation of those entities. So,
thank you very much.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm sort of coming to Mr. Gadd's defense a bit to put this in the context of your taxpayers, because sometimes it's suggested that if you're asking some of the taxpayers in the rest of the state to help with your local infrastructure, that that's somehow unfair, while at the same time all those Hopkins taxpayers continue to have their tax dollars go all over the state to help others with their infrastructure. And I think that kind of balance is something maybe we don't talk about a lot. But I mean, there's somehow the expectation that you should do it yourself, but you should, your tax dollars should go everywhere else to help them too. And it's a reminder that one needs to make from time to time.
Mr. Gadd, any final comments?
I said once again, I just appreciate my time to be here. So,
thank you so much for your testimony. Next, we have Jeff Strait, followed by David Lilly. Go ahead and Chair identify Torkel. Yourself for
yes.
the committee.
My name is Jeff Strait. I'm a resident in Eden Prairie. And I'm only representing myself today. However, I have been tracking and following and been engaged in public comment about Southwest Light Rail for the past 15 years. I've also been a strong advocate of our suburban bus company, commuter bus company, Southwest Transit. And that's why I'm here today. I'm not going to be able to go over facts and figures and how much it costs for this, but I have been engaged for a long time in this, particularly at the beginning when Hennepin County was trying to figure out the best alignment. I was one of the citizens and businesses that engaged the county during those hearing processes to get that route change, to get that alignment through Eden Prairie and Minnetonka and Hopkins change, that work. All by way of saying the system at the Hennepin County level and at the Met Council level for this project has been very thorough. It has engaged businesses, church groups, individuals like myself, bicyclers, chambers of commerce, city councils, city planners. I'm in accord with Commissioner McLaughlin, Mayor Schneider, and Councilmember Gadd from Hopkins. I've worked with these people over the years as a citizen. More recently, however, I've been part of the Southwest Light Rail Project's community advisory, Community Advisory Committee. That's a group of people like myself. We don't hold office anywhere. We just weigh in. We come from community groups. It is my insight and my belief and from my experience that planning is doing is very, very well thought out, and that the costs, of course, are considered in all these committees that have been weighing in on this. So the aspects of this bill that are taken away local control, I don't agree with. I don't think you should do that. My time is almost up here, but I would like to say that most of my family farms in Vernon Center, Minnesota. I was down there this weekend for my stepmom's 93rd birthday party. We go down every other week. On 169, there is always almost a traffic jam going between the Twin Cities, Mankato, and further southwest. There is no urban, rural division in our family. I know about what our problems are down in Vernon Center. We're successful farmers down there. But they're concerned, too, about what's going on up here. I'm concerned there, what's going down there, and the road control. Our roads are pretty good right now, but this division between urban and rural is untoward and really doesn't operate at the family level. I thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And excuse me, there is one question by Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is probably more a comment than a question, but I just want to echo what I just heard from this testifier, because I live near Vernon Center. I live in North Mankato, and I hear a lot of my neighbors saying the same thing, that this urban-rural divide doesn't work, and we've got to make sure that the metropolitan area is successful and that rural Minnesota is successful as well. So thank you for your comments.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you no doubt know, Tony Cornish, Representative Cornish, and Senator Julie Rosen are also from Vernon Center.
Thank you so much. Appreciate that. Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strait, you talked about the urban-rural divide, which I haven't really heard before, but if you're suggesting there's an urban-rural divide, would policies that allow the continuance of unelected groups to come forward and place tax liabilities on other people who will never use those facilities, would that help that divide, or would that exacerbate it?
Mr. Strait.
Chairman, Representative Jaskowski, the Met Council is indirectly appointed by, it's appointed by the governor, so they're indirectly elected. The Met Council, how it operates, works with elected officials at the county level, at the state level, and at the city level. I've been a citizen of that. So if you're referring to the Met Council on this, I disagree with you. I think this is an efficient way of managing a large, vibrant metro area, one of the best in the country. And sure, improvements can be made, but I've never had a problem with the fact that there is a Met Council under whatever governor there is, Republican or Democrat.
Any follow-up, Representative Scott?
I don't think I heard an answer there, Mr. Chair, but Mr. Strait, so would policies that that invoke tax liabilities for this infrastructure upon people who will never use it, would you say that would help build bridges with those people, or would that cause divide?
Mr. Strait.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jaskowski, I hope the bridges and roads are repaired and built. I might add that when my family comes up to the Twin Cities to see a Twins game, they park at Mall of America and ride the blue line to Target Field.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the absence of an answer is an answer. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate that. Mr. Lilly, please identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, my name is David Lilly. I am here on behalf of an organization called LRT Gun Right, which has had a constant presence here at the legislature and with this committee and Representative Brunbeck's committee, as various of the portions of this bill have wound their way through. I will be brief. I am here specifically to address Section 85 of the bill, which is the liability limitation portion, the old House File 229. We have had serious concerns about it and about the fact that this bill would, in fact, cap the railroad's liability in the event of an accident, probably capping it well below the level it should be or the level for which they could get insurance. But we have a broader concern, and I want to thank Representative Torkelson because he has tried to engineer the bill to make it clear that insofar as freight rail only operations exist, there will be no liability cap, and that is a useful addition to Section 85. But there's another part of Section 85 that no one has really focused upon, and that is the first paragraph. Section A of the bill. That paragraph gives the Met Council additional authority which they do not have currently, to own, operate, lease facilities for transit and for freight rail purposes. All of a sudden, should this piece of legislation be adopted, you will have, perhaps inadvertently, expanded the Metropolitan Council's statutory authority. And we're not certain that that represents a very good policy choice. And part of that relates, in fact, to the manner in which the Metropolitan Council is selected and governed. We also would like to endorse various other provisions in the bill that address light rail. We think they are, for the most part, good additions. In particular, Section 89. Had Section 89 been in law when Southwest LRT was first envisioned, I don't think we would have the controversy that we have today. There would have been a more thoughtful, deliberate, and I think reasonable outcome, not necessarily excluding light rail, but at least having to do with how light rail is built and where it is built and not co-located with enormously risky freight rail. I might add that I've just reviewed Mr. DeWinnick's letter to this committee commenting on various sections of the bill. He is silent on Section 85, so presumably he's not endorsing it, nor has a strong feeling about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We have Steve Novak and Jill Sletten next. Mr. Novak, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself and continue.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Steve Novak. I represent the Minnesota Inter-County Association on transportation issues. The Inter-County Association is made up of four of the five collar suburban counties, Dakota, Carver, Scott, and Washington, and 10 of the largest greater Minnesota counties in the state. First thing I want to do on behalf of our organization is thank the committee for the work they've done at this point. Recall over the last 18 months or so the bipartisan agreement that there was a $6 billion transportation challenge over 10 years, and this bill seems to approach that number in various combinations of ways, and which makes it quite a bit more significant than your counterpart at this point, so I want to say thank you for that. The second thing is we appreciate the focus on roads and bridges in many parts of this bill, but also agree that we do need to find a way to get more money for transit. The third thing I want to say is that we appreciate, frankly, that you don't have a provision on turnbacks, which will make you different than the other body. We hope you hold firm to that. Turnbacks are important issues to counties of the state in terms of our relationship with the county. And the turnback account is very important to us. Fourth, I want to commend you on your increase in funding for the Corridors of Commerce, an ongoing program that seems to be on the path to successes around Minnesota if we continue to find ways to fund it. The last thing I want to say is just to express a slight disappointment in terms of how the $32 million was handled, which has been in the bank in the state of Minnesota for quite a few years since the 2008 package, which emanated out of the deal that was struck that saw the money that comes in from the sales tax on leased vehicles over $32 million split 50-50 between the five collar counties, suburban counties, for roads and bridges, and the transit systems in greater Minnesota. We strongly agreed with House File 901, by your colleague, Representative Kosnick. We want to thank him publicly for the work he did on that. And just gently remind the committee that of all the different ways people have come up with to spend the $32 million in transportation, this was the one bill that actually went through three committees in the House, including the Tax Committee. And we know that this is a long process. This bill, like the other one, will have to be massaged, and we'd like to encourage you to keep in mind the pathway that Representative Kosnick had in House File 901 for the ultimate distribution of the $32 million, and wish you well in your journey, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And next we have Jill Slatton. Welcome, and please identify yourself for the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Torkelson and committee members. My name is Jill Slatton, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Small Cities. Of the 850 cities in Minnesota, more than 700 of those cities are 5,000 and under and receive no state money for their city streets. Our small city streets are essential to the mobility and economic vitality of our communities, and long-term sustainable funding for maintenance and reconstruction of our streets has remained unaddressed in transportation funding for over a decade. House File 861, the delete all, does not provide for a dedicated and a sustainable funding source. We thank Chair Torkelson for including the small city assistance account in his bill. However, we feel that a sustainable and dedicated funding source, the $10 surcharge on vehicle registration that is in House File 934, Representative Hornstein's bill, provides for both large and small cities and is a more reliable way to fund our city streets. Funding the small city assistance account through the general fund puts our funding source at a risk, and it will be hard for our small cities to plan their budgets year to year. Providing a dedicated and sustainable funding source will give small cities the security and reliability it needs to relieve our city residents of increased property taxes and special assessments. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate that. Dan Larson is next. And while he's coming down, we have 2, 4, 6, 7 others that have announced that they would like to testify, as well as we're going to ask if Sherry Munyon or Cameron Slick are here before we move to that. So at this time, we'll go to Mr. Larson.
Okay. Sure.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dan Larson. I'm representing Minnesota Rural Counties, a membership organization representing 30 counties in greater Minnesota and the only organization advocating on issues specific to rural counties. Pleased to be here and to be able to testify today. We understand that finding common ground on bridging the gap between growing needs and current funding levels is not an easy task. So we appreciate Representative Torkelson's effort in this regard. And while we have a lot of friends we like to think we do on this committee, there's certainly none greater than Representative Torkelson. However, we do have some concerns with the funding level overall, and which does not appear adequate to address current needs, much less an economically competitive world-class system we feel is necessary to build over the next 20 years. We also are concerned with the shifts from the general fund, and that those concerns are that they will not be sustainable over time, and that the best source of road and bridge funding for efficiency and planning purposes is our sources that are constitutionally dedicated. So the MRC believes that at least half of all new revenue for transportation purposes, road and bridge purposes, should be from sources that are constitutionally protected, and we are not alone. We, in January, we conducted our first survey of greater Minnesota counties and to find out what issues were important to them, and the issue that was far and away of the greatest concern to them reflected in those that responded was adequate and dedicated transportation funding, and that a full 100% of those responding either strongly or somewhat agreed that the majority of all transportation funding should be constitutionally dedicated. I don't need to remind this committee that the ag and food industry is the second largest employer in the state, and that the state leads the nation in production of sugar beets, turkeys, oats, sweet corn, and peas for processing. Nationally, Minnesota ranks third in production of beans and fourth in corn production. So farm to market and forest to market, that first haul out of the field or the forest, critically important. Local roads. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I again want to thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to you about the bill.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give me just I know we've heard various versions of this, but a sense of the condition of roads, that first mile that you're talking about.
the condition of those that first mile roads, it, particularly in the context of the move or the request that we're going to go to heavier trucks.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the question. I had the same question myself, so I got on a sugar beet truck in the harvest last year. And the concern that was raised to me, and I saw it firsthand, was 2017 technology, the big bins that were hauled, that were taken in the beans on 1945 roads. So they could fill, if they wanted to be legal, they could go halfway or maybe a little better if they want to cheat a little bit. And so at harvest time, trips are important. You want to get the greatest efficiencies. And they could not use today's technology on mid-20th century roads if they wanted to be legal. One example.
Representative Hull.
So is there anything that even remotely addresses that in a time frame that is actual, practical, or pragmatic? I mean, you gave a sense that it's way behind. I mean, that was a fairly dramatic timing of the condition. And so what are we looking at? We're looking at 50 years to bring those roads up. I mean, I'm over-exaggerating the point. So what term of years or how quickly can the road stock be brought into that it would then be able to accept the impact of these larger trucks?
Mr. Lars.
Mr. Chair, members, time-wise depends on funding. If you don't have the funding, you can't build out your five-year plans. And so that's why the funding level is so critical. Our organization looks back to a study that was done in 2012, TFAC. It was mentioned by the League of Cities. We look at those numbers, and that's why I mentioned a competitive world-class system, because in that TFAC study, they list them out. What do you want to do? Do you want to just simply maintain your current level of production, I guess, or economy, or do you want to go to a world-class system? And that's specifically why I recognized where we are with beans, turkeys, peas, those things. You have to have an infrastructure system that's going to allow you to compete in world markets. And Minnesota already is, but the infrastructure is not keeping up with the market.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And Sherry Munyon, if you'd like to come down, is Cameron Slick here yet? If not, before your testimony, I do want to just mention to the names that we have on the list that are outside of what was printed. We have a Deb McMillan, a Will Roach, Dan Duffy, Emma Spurgett, Joe Carlson, Phil Qualley, and Jessica Treat. If anybody else is interested in testimony, if you could please give the note to the page and let us know ahead of time. And with that, we'll start with Ms. Munyon. Please identify yourself and welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you first for calling on me again. I'm sorry I was out of the room. I'm Sherry Munyon, and I represent the Minnesota Public Transit Association, which is a membership-driven organization of bus systems and providers across the state. We have always supported a multimodal transportation funding proposal, recognizing the need for safe roads and bridges for automobiles as well as for our buses. While it is in the metropolitan area, whether it is in the metropolitan area or in greater Minnesota, all of our bus systems and providers are working hard to meet the growing demands of their citizens and their communities. MIPTA wants to express concern about the potential service cuts in the Twin Cities metropolitan area and urge that as the session progresses, funding can be found to prevent the service cuts they are facing. For greater Minnesota, MIPTA has long advocated for the remaining 50% of the lease vehicle revenue sitting in the general fund be dedicated to greater Minnesota transit. The current dedication of lease vehicle revenues has been extremely important to greater Minnesota transit. It was just a short while ago when transit systems were way over their statutorily required level of participation and putting in 30% of local revenues rather than the 15 or 20% that was required. While we were disappointed that the lease vehicle revenue wasn't made available, we do thank the author and the committee for looking at an alternative revenue source that has dedicated revenue to Greater Minnesota Bus Transit Systems. Greater Minnesota Systems long struggled for stable, increased funding. The dedicated funds for our bus systems are critical. It is not only on behalf of the citizens, the businesses that some of them drive to, the stores that they shop in, it's also critical in terms of those communities and their economic development, particularly in the smallest rural towns of Minnesota. So we look forward to continuing to work with you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We appreciate that. One more call for Cameron Slick. All right, then we'll move on to Deb McMillan and Will Roach. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and continue on with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Deb McMillan. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Twin West Chamber of Commerce. We represent over 700 businesses and 55,000 employees in the West Metro region. And I want to talk today about the importance of transit to the business community in terms of economic development and vitality, regional competitiveness, and the role of transit in the attraction and retention of workforce. Businesses are in a fierce competition to attract the best and the brightest talent and help maintain and grow the economy in their state, their region, and their communities. The ability of a region to attract and maintain that talent will help drive the economy. My members tell me often that access to workers is the number one impediment to their ability to grow. Accessibility to transit is incredibly important in efforts to attract workers to the region. 60 to 80,000 more jobs are expected to grow along the Southwest Light Rail Corridor over the next two decades. That is roughly the population of St. Cloud. Improved transit options will be critical in getting workers to those jobs and allowing employers to reach out to potential employees from the greater metropolitan area. Companies will go and grow where they are best able to meet the needs of their business. Make no mistake, the cities that we are competing with for federal transit dollars are the same cities we compete with for talent and jobs. The economic benefits to our region have already been realized in the already completed and the future development projects being planned in the Southwest Corridor. A few examples that are completed or currently under construction include developments of senior and market rate housing, a large corporate campus for United Health Group, and a major hospital expansion in St. Louis Park. I ask that you allow the Southwest Light Rail project to move forward and not impede the future growth of the Metro Transit system, as it is critical to our current and future economic and regional competitiveness. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it. Will Roach and Dan Duffy. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Will Roach. I am, for over 4 years, I've co-chaired the Business Advisory Committee for the Southwest Light Rail, and I'm also a Corridor Management Committee member. The Business Advisory Committee consists of small, medium, and large representatives. It is my belief that this current bill is short-sighted and supports a longer-term economic chokehold. I'm here in support of an integrated transit mechanism, including Southwest Light Rail, that is viewed as a necessary investment in our Twin Cities region. The Mayo Clinic's foundation was established when Dr. Mayo said, "We are going to turn idealism into action." My view of ideology versus facts. Current light rail ridership exceeds estimates. 80% of riders are people going to and from work and school. This has been a well-thought-out plan where five cities, Minneapolis, St. Louis Park, Hopkins, Minnetonka, and Eden Prairie, along with Hennepin County, have approved this project twice. We have an ever-growing population segment and workforce that does not want to own cars and wants to live near transit. In fact, this is now including an aging population that is seeking access to transit. Since 2008, this project alone has had over 800 community and business meetings attended by over 25,000 people. This line reaches densely populated areas, including Royalston, Bassett Creek, And this line reaches workers from Opportunity Partners to United Health Group. Two-thirds of Minnesota counties had workers involved with the Green Line project. And 200 businesses, contractors, and subcontractors have recently have attended informational meetings. It is my belief that the Twin Cities region needs to be viewed as an economic asset to the state of Minnesota. Integrated transit is a real opportunity for our region, both with buses and light rail. Those in Mankato and Rochester are now seeing opportunity of regional transit synergies. Our roads are already congested. Light rail has shown benefits to reverse commuting, as well as allowing access for companies finding employees throughout our region. We've seen historic examples of non-transit investment, Detroit. We've also seen regions that have made light rail transit investments, Denver, Fort Worth, Dallas, Phoenix, Pittsburgh, and Salt Lake City thrive. In fact, the Fort Worth area and Dallas have the largest light rail lines in the nation. There's a reason why projects are extremely competitive. Integrated transit of bus and light rail transit attracts the highly sought-after workforce and drives economic development. In fact, the Green Line from St. Paul to Minneapolis has helped drive nearly 3 to 4 times return on investment. Southwest Light Rail is a specific corridor of commerce opportunity. It has been vetted for where we cannot expand roads, we cannot expand highways, and we cannot expand bridges. This is a corridor that is anticipating 65,000 new employees over the next decade. Last fact, already $500 million of private capital, and that is a capital with an A, has been invested along the corridor in anticipation of Southwest Light Rail being built. You've read Fortune 500 CEOs in support of this. The Twin Cities Chambers of Commerce and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce have consistently both supported an integrated transit for the metro area, buses and Southwest Light Rail. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And next we'll move on to Dan Duffy. Oh, I'm sorry. Got one question here. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Roach, you mentioned 5 cities in Hennepin County are for this. Are there any cities in Hennepin County against this Southwest Light Rail?
Mr. Roach?
Chair, Mr. Representative, I am not aware of, nor have, to my knowledge, been having a vote. I can tell you that there have been additional representation from local municipalities, including Edina, as actively involved in this process. I've also witnessed, in my perspective, both committees acting in very appropriate financial perspectives along this line, as well as, in my knowledge of being on the Corridor Management Committee, all cities have invested additional dollars in support of Southwest Light Rail.
Thank you. Again, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Move on to Dan Duffy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dan Duffy, and I am representing Business Advisory Committee. I'm the co-chair with Will on that, and I'm also representing the Twin West Chamber of Commerce. Combined, these two organizations represent over 700 businesses and tens of thousands of employees in the Southwest Metro region. The BAC and the Twin West view the Southwest project as vital to provide economic development and job opportunities throughout the entire metro region, not just the Southwest corridor. Our business organizations understand that improving transit options in the Southwest metro region will help support the over 60,000 jobs that are projected to grow over the next 2 decades. LRT will help reduce the commute times for employees traveling from the north, east, and southern parts of the metro region, as well as give job employers in the Southwest the opportunity to reach out to potential employees from the greater metropolitan area. The Twin West Chamber has been an unwavering partner at the table throughout the process from the very beginning back in 2002 when the Policy Advisory Committee was planned. Beginning with the lengthy and detailed studies of various modes of transit options for the corridor, then followed by a comprehensive study of alignment options to where we are today with the current scope and budget to meet the local and federal matching funds required. We understand the importance of finding cost-effective solutions that will not sacrifice projected ridership, yet still maintain our high approval rating at the federal level and rank as one of the next projects up. We believe the current project budget and scope with major transit stations anchored at both ends meets this goal. At times, while this project has been slowed by the political realities often present with projects of this magnitude, we chose to keep our focus on the data and the facts presented to us by the various partners and consultants. Throughout this process, we have heard from many people that oppose the project, saying that it has no economic benefit to the region. But in reality, we know the economic benefits that are demonstrated in the many completed and future development projects that are currently in the planning stages. And Deb and Mayor Schneider had already mentioned some of those projects. There are also projects that are being planned that involve over millions of dollars worth of investment. Combined, these three development projects along the corridor provide housing, employ thousands of people, even without Southwest LRT project being developed yet. Therefore, on behalf of the business organizations I represent, we oppose any amendment and bill that would stop this project, and I ask that you continue to allow the project to move forward and not impede at the federal level. The FTA cannot simply transfer federal funds from a comprehensive capital investment grant to a transit block grant, and any unused Southwest LRT New Starts federal funds would deposit back into the capital investment grant only to be awarded elsewhere in America to the cities that were competing against, that Will had mentioned, Seattle, Dallas, San Diego, Denver, Baltimore, and so forth. In conclusion, the Southwest project will help grow jobs and improve transit mobility in our entire metro region so that we can continue to compete nationally for the workforce of the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Duffy. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, we've heard again and again about the increase of jobs in that area. What do you think will happen if the Southwest Light Rail does not go through? How will that impact the expansions of some of those companies?
Mr. Duffy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. We know it's been difficult for companies. One of the three, let me back up to say that the three main concerns when job seekers, when employers are looking to relocate to this metro region, the three questions that they ask our chambers are, what is your education of your workforce? What is your tax base of your businesses? And what kind of public transportation do you have? If we don't expand our public transportation and provide better quality transportation, it would be difficult for people to relocate there. When we started this process years ago, we actually looked at how could we improve roads and bridges and expand the roads and bridges in that Southwest Metro region, because we knew it was an attractive area for jobs to grow. We studied it for a long time and determined that we just did not have the capacity to expand roads and bridges. Then we spent a long time studying how we could expand BRT and even enhanced and express BRT. After studying that for a long time, we discovered that it could not move enough people efficiently and economically. So that's why we settled on LRT. So ultimately, to answer your question, it would be difficult. I think that jobs may look at other parts of the region, or they may look at other states that have a little bit better tax base.
Representative Rinbeck.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Duffy. Can you tell us how many new-to-transit riders will be attracted to the Southwest Light Rail? New-to-transit?
New-to-transit?
Correct.
Including transit riders already that are using it today. We can project that the ridership will be about 27,000 to 30,000 daily, but that's going to include metro region transit riders. Keep in mind that today we only have a half of a system built out. We don't have an entire metro system built out. So the projected ridership, new, I guess, would be in that 27,000 to 30,000 ridership, but they may be riders who are riding to the East Metro area.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Duffy, I mean, I think if you look at the supplemental EIS, you'll read that there are 6,500 new-to-transit riders along that corridor because many of them already have the option of using the opt-out bus. So 6,500 cars off the road for a total investment of $1.8 billion. And that's not including the operating costs that we will be subsidizing on into perpetuity. How does this make sense?
Mr. Chair and Representative, in regards to the operating cost, how do we fund our buses? How do we fund our roads and bridges? The roads and bridges aren't completely financed through the gas tax, and the buses are subsidized. This is a major transportation project that we're building out that's going to last over 100 years. It will be subsidized. It's going to create economic development, which will offset some of that subsidies, is the projected growth of jobs and employment and people living in the area that will create a tax base to help support that.
Representative Redbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a follow-up then. Could you tell us what you anticipate is going to be the size of the total capital investment in the completed transit network? Do you know what that number is? The plan that's been put forward by CTIB and so on, what is the cost of that project?
Mr. Duffy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. and Representative. When you say the completed package of the total transit network, are you talking about all of the light rail systems, all the BRT, all of the roads and bridges and everything like that?
Representative Rebecca?
Mr. Chair, that's right.
That Mr. answer Duffy. Would have to come from the Met Council. I don't know the exact number of the entire system.
And, Mr. Chair, I think just the point is that nobody really has that number. Nobody knows. I mean, we are being sort of led along project by project. That's why we need to kind of say, halt, and let's look at this and know what we're buying into. Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you may not have this information, but it was my understanding that the suburban transit route that was referenced doesn't stop in Hopkins and St. Louis Park, which, as I understand it, are fairly significant underserved populations in those two areas. I don't know if that's information you have, but that's my understanding.
And are you talking about BRT, or are you talking about...
Well, the line that, I can't remember the line that represented... 495. What was the line that Representative Runbeck referenced, that she said that this was already served by...
Representative Runbeck, can we clarify?
Chair, President Hausman, Southwest Light Rail, served by the opt-out bus system.
Right, and so that's that opt-out that she referenced, it's a suburban line, doesn't stop in Hopkins and St. Louis Park, is my understanding.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Duffy, and Representative, if you're referring to the Southwest bus metro system, the express bus metro system, that I don't have that answer, but I think you're correct that it doesn't stop in Hopkins and the other areas. I think that just goes from Eden Prairie to downtown, so I don't think that would apply.
Thank you so much, Mr. Duffy, for your testimony. Next, we'll move on to Emma Spurgut and Joe Carlson. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself and continue on with testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. my name is Emma Spurgut. I'm a high school senior at Southwest, and I take all of my classes at the University of Minnesota through the PSEO program. I, along with many other students, rely on the public transit system to get to school every day, and without it, I would likely not be able to attend classes at the university. Many students at the high schools also reap the benefits of the public transportation system, as it allows for flexibility that the traditional school bus system cannot offer. Students who stay after school for activities can now take the bus home after school almost any time, and students like me can take advantage of opportunities outside of Southwest or use the bus system to get to work or extracurriculars after class. For young people who can't afford cars, public transportation system is very valuable. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your testimony. You did a great job. Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much. Well, I wanted to thank Ms. Spurgut, too. She lives in the district I represent. And, you know, in addition, I thought that, you know, Mr. Reeves and Mr. Maddox and Ms. Foster and maybe others who talked about their, you know, reliance on the transit system, I am also in that category. I take transit every day. For a variety of reasons, but and I think for us, you know, this 10% reduction is hugely problematic. So for Ms. Spurgut and I, the number 6 bus, which goes through our neighborhood, you know, that's our Highway 14. The number 6 bus is our Highway 23. The number 6 bus is our Highway 212. And so I want to get a sense that, you know, I support all of those highway projects that I mentioned. But this is for thousands of people who live in the district I represent. Highway, you know, our highway is the number 6 bus. And so that's why I think, you know, we'll talk more about this tomorrow, but, you know, we really do need to start thinking about the fact that we're one Minnesota. And these bus lines are our lifeline, and they're our commerce, and our way to school, and our way to work, and serve seniors and people with disabilities and others that can't drive and others who choose not to. And so for the millennials, you know, many of them in my area are taking the bus. So just wanted to make that point and to thank the transit riders that, that shared their stories with us. And thank you, Ms. Spurgett.
Thank you, Representative. And thank you for the testimony. Appreciate that. Next, we have Joe Carlson, followed by Philip Cawley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. That's a hard act to follow.
Please identify yourself and for the committee and continue.
Mr. Chairman, Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. And the lawyers that I represent are not here to express an opinion. I have the luxury of not having to have an opinion about Southwest Light Rail, but I do have an opinion about Section 85 of the bill as it relates to rail liability. And we struggled through this issue in the Civil Law Committee, and I thank Chair Torkelson for making some changes to the bill, but we still have some particular questions about the language. Now, I know as we read this, you are saying that for all claims on lines in two places, but on lines 90.18 and 90.24, all claims relating to the corridor for a Class 1, 2, or 3 railroad are going to be limited to the amount of liability for a municipality for all injuries. And that's $1.5 million per incident. And there's a concern with that. And the biggest concern I have is that while you talk about, well, that has to occur within the joint and shared use, and it has to involve both the freight and the light rail, it doesn't make a distinction as to who is at fault. And so you could have the Class 1, 2, or 3 railroad who's at fault for the accident and now pick up the municipal liability cap of $1.5 million. When this language was first brought to the legislature in 2006 as it related to the commuter rail line, the North Star, you need to know that at that point when the legislature approved that, we knew a couple things that were very important. Number one, the state and the rail line were in partnership in running that commuter rail line, and they were going over the same track. So there was a partnership there on the track. That's not the case here. You also need to know that at the time, and it has increased since, at the time, there was a mandated federal law that required rail passenger to carry a $100 million liability insurance policy. That has now been increased twice. First was increased to $200 million. It's now at $300 million. We have no idea what the liability limits are for a Class 3 railroad. And we also don't want to put a Class 1 railroad into this section because it creates a confusion in the law between Section 174, where they have a $300 million limit, and this section now where it might be substantially lower. I've had a chance to talk with the rail lines about this, and they've been very cooperative in sharing what their concerns are. But as written right now, this language I think is problematic and could have some very substantial consequences, particularly when an accident and explosion is the the negligence of the rail line and not anything that the Southwest line happened to be involved in. So those are our comments, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you taking a little bit of time to think about this issue.
Thank you. And if I could ask just a couple questions. So if there's an explosion that's caused by the Southwest Light Rail derailing and causing the incident, whose responsibility is it, and would there be limitations to that liability?
Mr. Chairman and members, I have to think about the – you're talking about the line that's run by Met Council, right?
Right.
I think they pick up some liability protections, and that gives me concerns as well. I think they insure, and it's important that they added into this bill – Chapter 46606, because if you insure above the cap, then you've waived that cap up to the level of your insurance, and I know the Met Council does that. But there are limitations, and that gives me some concern, and many of you were here, but I represented the victims of the I-35W bridge collapse.
Sure. Thank you.
That was a problem.
I mean, I think there's some limitations there, too. And the other question that I have, just in regards to the difference between the North Star and this particular rail, is that now these are going to be passing each other, whereas in the North Star, they can't share the same track. They have to actually follow or whatever. So doesn't that automatically also increase some risk in regards to the fact that Southwest Rail is now going past each other rather than sharing the same track. And it seemed to me that would actually increase the risk and because of the Southwest Light Rail, not because of the railroad.
I don't disagree with that, Mr. Chairman. And I acknowledge that that's one of the reasons the rail lines want this, because there is an increased risk when you have some type of passenger rail going in the, not on the same track, but in the same corridor.
Right.
My question is when the injury or the accident occurs from the result of the rail line, do we want to put this hard cap of a municipal damage cap when the injury or the accident is the result of the rail line, not the result of the Southwest?
Thank you so much.
Questions.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm reading the language, Mr. Carlson. Help us understand what you're saying here, because on line 23 and 24 on page 90, it says that it applies when involving both freight rail and light rail transit. So can you help better describe what you're talking about?
Sure.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, before I get to that, I want you to just bump up just a little bit, Representative Draskowski, and look at lines 190.18. So we're talking about all types of claims or damages. So the qualifier to that is on 2.3 and 2.4. So it has to occur within the right-of-way in the corridor, and it has to involve freight rail and light rail, which is how all of these are going to happen. So to me, it's all claims and all damages involving the freight line and the rail line, even if it's the freight line's fault. That's where my problem lies.
Representative Draskowski?
Gotcha. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Carlson.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to point out that the North Star, while they may not be operating at the same track at the same time, there are dual tracks there. So there could be freight running on track coming one direction, and so they are be in a similar situation of running in the same corridor, so that the situation that you raised could happen there also. Freight train could derail, cause an accident, or the passenger train could derail and cause an accident. So I think, and I asked some of these questions when they came to my office. The rail people came to my office and talked about this provision that they want to put in the bill, and I do have some concerns, and I do share those concerns, and we probably need to tweak it so that that it works for both entities.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Carlson. I'm very strongly opposed to this section, but my question is there anything in federal law that requires railroads to share information about liability, or prevents them from sharing information about liability
Mr.
to
Carlson.
A public body?
Mr. Carlson.
I told Mr. Appitz that the level of my rail knowledge is getting a little bit past my Lionel collection. So I don't want to, I can get an answer for you to that, Representative Hornstein, and maybe another witness has it, but I don't want to speculate on that.
Thank you, because I think it's important. Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Representative Hornstein.
We had a discussion last week about this in committee, and I did an amendment to delete this section, and the rail company basically said they're not willing to do that, they're not able to do that, they're not required to do that. So I just want to get some clarity about that.
And Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Carlson,
and Representative Hornstein, I can tell you from the people that I work with that have cases with railroads that it's hard to get that information, but I can't point to a federal law or statute that allows them to protect it or release it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Again, thank you for your testimony. We have a question from Representative Turkelson.
Mr. Carlson, sorry to delay your departure.
I would
like to get you out here more quickly. And perhaps you covered this, but surely all across the country there are cases where there's co-location of freight rail and passenger rail. Have you looked into how this is handled in other states?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dorkelson, I have not, and it's a good question, and it's one that I think we should provide some research on. For me, we did do the research when it was commuter rail, and we did know what the federal law required as far as liability coverage. I personally have not done that to see if there's a distinction between a light rail line and heavy rail, and I'll do that and get back to you.
I'd appreciate that very much, and I'm just, you know, again, I'm offering to do the best we can with this.
Yeah, I appreciate the changes you made.
We'll be happy to continue working with you.
Representative Sell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just sort of wrapped up what I was going to say. I'm aware of a line in Elmhurst, Illinois, where they have freight, and it's both high and low-speed freight running through the corridor, and then there's two lines of passenger rail, not light rail. Some of that could be the distinction of how you're facilitating the passenger part of it, but they've got three rails going through the city, and like I said, some of it's very high speed, some of it's low speed, and it is also running contiguous on all of them at the same time. So they must have ways of managing that liability, but there could be distinctions on which type of rails are there.
And Mr. Chairman and Representative Sock, that's exactly the distinction that I kind of want to try and be able to at least illuminate for you, because I know what it is. I know what the federal law is as it relates to passenger rail on heavy rail lines, and I know it's $300 million. I can't say that for light rail, and that's where I need to find that distinction.
Again, thank you for your testimony, and next we'll go to Phil Qualley and then Jessica Treat.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you very much.
And welcome.
Thank you very much. I'll be brief at this late hour. Regarding House File 861, we want to certainly respect your work on this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to speak. Regarding Section 85, we want to thank you for recognizing rail labor and workers' rights under Paragraph D. However, we too share and are concerned regarding Paragraphs A and C. Respectful of your work, we are very concerned about the liability for the public in potential freight operations. When I speak of being overly broad, this references not only Class 1 and Class 2 carriers, but Class 3. I recognize from MnDOT's records that Twin City and Western, if this is the railroad that this is intended to assist alongside Southwest Light Rail, is presently considered a Class 3. Pretty close to a Class 2 operation. Perhaps we should be taking a look at TC&W's total gross operating revenues to see if they're in fact a Class 2, and perhaps we could omit that Class 3. My concern with Class 3 carriers are, with all due respect to people who want to get into the railroad business, it can be some pretty loose operating practices, mechanical track practices. And my concern is then, as this section is written, as we get into the seven-county metro area, Class 3s operating with this type of liability shield in the seven-county metro area. So, and just briefly, in other areas, I would like to just mention that what is not in House File 861, hopefully you'll reconsider, Section 67, Rail Safety Hazmat Training, currently omits our workers' needs to have to be involved in evacuation planning, evacuation drills and preparedness, as well as the exercises. We'd hope that perhaps you'd consider a friendly amendment. Our railroad workers in the yards do not get evacuation drills, and we can go through that in detail at a later time. Another section on the quiet zone, Section 68, want to applaud your work. We recognize the public's need there. However, we omit the subject area of minimum train crew requirement, and that did not receive a hearing this year, and we hope that over the summer we can better educate and reach out to the serious need for crossing safety with two people on all trains. And then finally, we hope the committee would reconsider and fund the MnDOT Passenger Rail Office. We're just very concerned that our region remain competitive across the world in the United States, and the Passenger Rail Office is an integral piece of that. Thank you very much for hearing my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Qualley. I appreciate your testimony. Thank you so much. Next, we have Jessica Treat, and I've heard Cameron Slick is here, so we would take his after that. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the committee.
All right, thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members. My name is Jessica Treat. I am the Executive Director of Transit for Livable Communities and St. Paul Smart Trips. As the largest transportation advocacy nonprofit in the state, we represent thousands of Minnesotans who support expanding options for transit, walking, bicycling, and sharing. We also lead Transportation Forward, a broad statewide coalition calling for new investments in all modes of transportation to improve mobility, economic health, and quality of life in communities across Minnesota. Minnesotans of all ages and abilities should be able to easily reach the destinations that are critical to their everyday lives, to their work, their school, their doctor, their grocery store. Increasingly, they want and need more options for getting where they need to go. Particularly in a time of budget surplus, why are we here talking about severe cuts to Metro Transit? It's unwarranted and unwise. As Representative Torkelson has said, transportation is one of the fundamental areas government is expected to fund. Slashing transit funding serves to put us further behind in meeting the mobility needs of our seniors, our families, our employers and workers, of communities of color, and our other neighbors across our metro and state. This bill does not do right by Minnesotans, especially in a time of budget surplus. Investing in all modes of transportation, including bus and rail, is essential to ensuring all Minnesotans have safe streets, clean air, healthy communities, and affordable access to jobs and opportunity. We have heard from so many Minnesotans who are already being impacted by the legislature's persistent lack of investment in transportation options. Like Leslie Ann, the worker who spent so much time on the bus commuting between Minneapolis and the suburbs that she had to leave a well-paying job. Like Regina, the mom who gave up driving due to vision loss and then had to withdraw her daughter from preschool because of limited transit options. There are many Minnesotans who depend on bus and rail options. Starving the metro area transit system will leave them stranded. Think about what the drastic cuts in this bill will mean for Maria, the commuter college student who relies on the bus to affordably access a good education at the U of M, or Amos, the metro area man who makes ends meet by walking to work in the morning and then taking transit across the Twin Cities to get to a second job, or Darren, who was able to accept a new job opportunity by combining bus and bike for his commute to the suburbs. With these Minnesotans in mind, I urge you to increase funding for bus and rail transit and for all modes of transportation statewide. Please do right by Minnesota today and into the future and take us forward rather than backward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Street. Appreciate your testimony. Is Cameron Slick here? And then while he's coming up, I have two additions to the list. I have Carolyn Jackson and Pam Johnson. If anybody else is interested, please let pass. No. Plus one additional, I guess. So thank you, and welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Cameron Slick. I'm a train conductor as well, and I live in the Minnehaha neighborhood of Minneapolis. I periodically use trains to get to work, and I use the Blue Line several times weekly for errands and recreation. And I would like to express that failure to fully fund Metro Transit and other agencies would be a step backward, and a fare hike would be very regressive on the working people across the Twin Cities, and a service reduction would be extremely detrimental to the ability of people to work, mobility of youth, elderly, and tourists. As a student of history, I took great interest in the old streetcar system of the Twin Cities, but rather than reminisce about the romantic comfort of trolleys, I wanted to talk about the historic fares adjusted for inflation at the end of the nickel fare era, which was 1920 or so. Fares would have been about 90 cents today, and a major fare hike during the deregulation of the streetcar system by rotten gangster owners would have raised the fares to about $1.82 today, which is just about where it's at right now. Any fare hike on Metro Transit would bring fares to basically an all-time high. While I personally own a car, operating expenses of automobiles are somewhat expensive, and I want to continue to be able to use the bus and light rail, as well as having a safe, healthy route to work, to parks, to bars and restaurants by bicycle. I would implore this committee to invest in bus, rail, biking, and walking options. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate that. Next, we have Carolyn Jackson, and then Pam Johnson. Please, welcome to the committee and identify yourself.
Sorry. Thank you. My name is Carolyn Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. First, I'd like to thank the committee for putting forth a substantial bill. The needs for transportation across our state are indeed substantial. We all want to thank you for putting sustained funding for the Small City Street Aid. Our members were very thankful in 2015 to get funding, and they said it would be much more helpful if they could depend on it, and so thank you for that. I do want to express a concern about two things. One is for the Corridors of Commerce program. This is a program that's very important to the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. It connects our regional centers. Without a cash funding source for Corridors of Commerce, however, I feel that this will not be particularly effective for a lot of our projects. the planning dollars cannot be used from bonding proceeds, and so we're a little disappointed that there was no cash funding for quarters of commerce, because we do want to do some land acquisition, environmental work, engineering work on a number of these projects across the state. Finally, I want to express our concern about the reliance on general fund dollars in this bill. The Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities has taken a position against relying on general fund dollars for the overall transportation project. We are very concerned about the effect this will have on the state's ability to fund local government aid in future years. That said, thank you for all your work.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Next, we'll move on to Pam Johnson. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself and continue the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Pamela Johnson, Stillwater, Minnesota. 2 years ago, before my father passed away, I had his driver's license revoked at the doctor's office. I'm determined not to take the same path myself as I grow older. I recently took Uber. It was a great experience. I like to take the Green Line from Union Station to Target Field to visit my oldest son. Again, a great experience. I'm looking forward to the Gateway Corridor being implemented so I can take a bus line to Union Station to catch the Green Line. My oldest son, a recent graduate of UW-Madison, computer science and mechanical engineering, moved to the North Loop with the idea of taking the Southwest Light Rail to Optum. I'm discouraged to see that there's a House bill that limits future development of the light rail system. I think it's a wonderful way to get around. I encourage more development going forward of light rail in the metro area. I don't want my children to go through what I did with my father. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate that. The last testifier that I have on the list is Chief John, I'm going to get this wrong, Frutell. Not here?
Well, is he the first one?
All right. Well. I'll put out a plea for anybody else who would like to testify either for the bill or with concerns. Please come to the table. Please identify yourself for the committee and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We are limiting this to 3 minutes.
Yes. My name is Matt Hollinsett. I live in Highland Park in St. Paul. I am a member of the Citizens Advisory Committee of Southwest Light Rail. I'm also an alternate to the Transportation Advisory Board, the Met Council. And I've been active in transportation advocacy for about 20 years. The thing I want to say today is that being born and raised in the East Metro, the Southwest Light Rail is of vital importance to the East Metro, not just the West Metro. We have in Summit University and Frogtown and other areas, East Side St. Paul, we have a lot of people who want good jobs, need good jobs. They can't afford the $9,000 a year for an extra car for their household. They can't get through all of the congestion, which I'm sure you all know is very bad in the West Metro at peak times and other times. And they have trouble retaining or taking a job offer in the West Metro. So this is not just a West Metro line. This is an extension of a cross-metro line. And as a resident and a native of St. Paul, I urge you to remove from this bill any restrictions that would hamper the timely, on-budget completion of Southwest Light Rail. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Again, any other further testimony by anybody from the audience or against? With that, I thank you all for those that testified. I appreciate you for that. We will be meeting again at 1 o'clock tomorrow, and we will be dealing with amendments and so forth, and I'm going to turn it over to Chair Torkelson for final comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious if there's any interest in doing some discussion today in order to facilitate our efforts tomorrow. I realize you may not be prepared for that at this point, but we are hoping to get the bill out of committee during regular committee time tomorrow because of some timeline considerations.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. I think that's a good idea. However, I've already had a couple of members tell me that they need to get going. But I'm pretty confident that we could probably finish tomorrow in the allotted time. I want to make sure that all of our members are here, and I already have two that need to go.
All right, that's fine, Representative Hornstein. It's not an effort to cut anybody off. We had a little extra time.
I'm glad you asked. It's a good idea.
We'll try to accommodate that tomorrow. Representative Hausman, question.
Just out of curiosity, Mr. Chair, will there be an author's amendment? Have you reworked any parts of the bill that maybe would be helpful for us to?
At this point, Representative Hausman, I think we are. I don't know if we've posted any of them yet. We're going to have approximately 8 amendments. I think more than I would like, honestly, but.
I don't know how many he was working on.
And we're expecting. We're still an hour from amendment deadline, so there may be
more. It just occurred to me, Mr. Chair, that if you were changing any substantial part of the bill, that this might give us an opportunity to get a.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. The amendments, as I see them, are not substantial changes to the bill. There's a couple of items that got left out, a couple of other items that need some repair. But you can certainly take a look at the amendments once they're posted.
And just to follow up, Mr. Lee is not here. I'm assuming he's getting from MnDOT that, we wanted to see how is this bonding thing going to really work, being paid for by cash, and how much, because it grows, if we sort of see what happens over the 20 years, and I think he was going to request that from MnDOT.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. I believe that he is. I know he, had some questions about that. He was going to try and get answered. So hopefully he's getting that done. That's why he's I know he's working. Put it that way. Representative South.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I get into the legal parts of what I was hearing, I'm way outside my pay grade. But I do know enough about these kinds of things and have been close enough to them that what I heard was sufficient to cause me great concern as to how this liability stuff is being managed in this corridor. So do we have a strategy afoot to bring that to rest? And maybe I'm asking too vague a question.
No, thank you, Representative Salk. I appreciate that question. Ever since this came to us, I've been working, willing to listen and work with those that are concerned about the issue. And I hope that we can find a solution. As I've stated from the beginning, my desire is to try and protect the short line railroad that is co-located in this corridor. It's important to my part of the state, and freight service into the metro is really critical for their existence.
Yeah.
So I've heard the concerns today. Some of them are new, and we'll try to address them. Excuse me. I think I need to go home. That's what I think. Members, we're adjourned.